I guess I'll call the complaint screening committee mini meeting to order. My computer says it's April 8, 2022 at 8:30 a.m. Ms. Pakkinen, will you please call the roll?
I'll do
Yes,
the
Mr.
roll. Mr. Diner?
Present.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
We have quorum.
Thank you. So on the agenda, we have approval for the October 20, 2021 regular session minutes and executive session minutes. This was a meeting where it was me, Dr. Meyer, and Dr. Gill, and Dr. Gill is not on the board, so it's going to be just me and Dr. Meyer. So I'm going to make a motion to approve the minutes of the October 20, 2021 regular session and executive session minutes. Do I have a second?
Seconded.
Thank you. Motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed. The motion passes. I'm going to make a motion to adjourn the mini CSC meeting. Second.
Seconded.
Motion and second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. None opposed. Motion passes. We are adjourned.
Call the ARC meeting to order. That is the Application Review Committee of the Arizona Board of Psychologists Examiner. Ms. Folks, could you do the roll call, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Malott? Can you hear me,
Yeah,
Dr. Malott?
we can hear you, but we didn't hear anything after.
Oh, I just was, all right, for the roll call, please say aye if you're here, Dr. Malott?
Yeah.
Dr. Meyer?
Here.
You have a quorum.
Okay. Do I hear a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second. Did we lose somebody? Do I hear a second, Dr. Meyer? Oh,
Yes.
I have to do the second. Yeah, you move. Sorry. Second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion approved. Do I hear a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay.
Oh, the full board meeting. The time is now 8:33 a.m. on April 8, 2022, and I call the meeting of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. This meeting is video hosted using Zoom. The public and parties on this agenda have been properly noticed of this fact and have been supplied with meeting access instructions. Ms. Pacnun, would you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair, Dr. Davis Wilson.
Present.
Dr. Davy.
Present.
Dr. Catarino.
Present.
Mr. Dinar.
Present.
Dr. Meyer.
Present.
Dr. Malott.
Present.
Ms. Shreve.
Present.
And Mr. Wynn.
Present.
Thank you. We have a quorum.
Thank you. Please note that the times stated on the agenda are approximate. The board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend the discussion of one agenda item, proceed to a timed item, and then return to a former agenda item at a later time. The board may also reorder non-timed items. The board encourages everyone in attendance today to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form. You'll find a link on the meeting agenda that is posted to the board's website. I want to take a moment to recognize all of the board members for their continued hard work. Each board member spends many hours preparing for each meeting. We do appreciate the time and effort that goes into the preparation for these meetings and the time spent on the calls with us. I'd also like to acknowledge the efforts of board staff and our attorney who do make our job much easier in ensuring that we have all of the documentation available, present, all of our questions are quickly answered. We do appreciate all of the work that you guys put forth for these meetings as well. Attendance of the board meeting is eligible for continuing education credit if it is at least 4 hours long. Should its duration be 4 hours or more, make note of the code words provided throughout the meeting. To report the code words to board staff for purposes of earning continuing education credit, look for the link on the board's meeting page for this particular meeting. It is possible that today's meeting will not be the 4 hours in duration. And if not, we do thank you for joining us and we thank you for your understanding. We'll now move to the call to the public. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board will limit the number of persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any public comment matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 3 minutes to do so. Pursuant to ARS 38-431.02H, the board may only take action on matters listed on the agenda. The board members may not discuss the matter with each other or with the member of the public addressing the board. The only option available is to instruct staff to place the topic on a future agenda, if applicable. Those wishing to speak, please unmute your line and state your name, and I will call on you. Hearing none, we will move to agenda item number 5, Board Council's update. Ms. Galvin, do you have an update for the board?
I do not at this time, thank you.
Thank you. We will move to agenda item number 6, the consent agenda. For the record, are there any recusals from items on the consent agenda? Hearing none, a board member may request to remove an item from the consent agenda for independent discussion. Are there any such requests? Is there a motion to approve the items on the consent agenda?
So moved.
Do we have a second?
I'll second.
All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries. We will now move to agenda item number 13, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding report in the 2022 annual convention of the Association of Professional Behavior Analysts. I am the lead for this agenda item and will provide a summary of this matter for the board. Last month, board staff, as well as myself, were able to attend the annual APBA conference. This conference historically has been kind of the landmark of public policy for the behavior analysts and continues to do so. At the last board meeting, we did vote on sending board staff to the meeting for the purpose of agenda items that were related to regulatory issues and regulatory topics for behavior analysts. While we were hoping to continue to move them in a direction of perhaps having a full track for legislation, they did have a few topics that were of interest that we were able to attend. It was very warm and welcoming. I believe that the only board staff that were present was Arizona's board, which is, I think, a great representation. There was board members from other boards. And we were able to meet both in a meeting format and then also the BACB, the certification board, was kind and provided a regulator's breakfast where we had the opportunity to kind of talk with regulators from other states. Very similar to what an ASPPB meeting would look like as far as the format of the regulatory matters. A lot of discussion, a lot of kind of doing an overview of what states are doing what. I found it to be very informative, actually. I think the agenda items that they actually had on the conference did include quite a bit of opportunity to hear how other boards are administering their regulations. And it was quite eye-opening and interesting. We did have a good turnout of behavior analysts that just joined in the meeting to listen in. And I think overall it was great, and I'm hopeful that it'll continue to progress. Ms. Pakanon, Ms. Michelson, do either one of you want to add additional information?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would. Ms. Michelson, do you want to go first, or would you prefer that I do?
Sure, I can just add something briefly. I do appreciate the opportunity that we had as board staff to attend this conference. And I really think it was a good opportunity to build upon our rapport with the BACB staff and also hear from other regulators. And I think it was three or four other states that attended the regulators meeting and hear what they're doing in their states, and also hear from some of the behavior analysts, their questions. And I think, you know, from my perspective, it definitely highlighted that there's somewhat of a disconnect where, you know, a lot of the licensees may not understand the difference between the BACB, the licensing boards, and how can we, you know, work together to educate them and early on in the process. So I don't think we necessarily have answers to those questions, but it's something that we're working towards together.
Yes, and Madam Chair, I agree with everything Ms. Michelson said and would only add that I feel as though we have some experience by virtue of having been regulators for a number of years with other professions, to including psychology, of course. And so I think we are well positioned to serve in a leadership role moving forward with respect to more regulatory topics appearing at this particular meeting. So I'd like to see some expansion of what we experienced at this convention, which was incredibly valuable. And what I took away too is that there needs to be a concerted effort to do better with respect to educating behavior analytics students to prepare for life as a regulated professional. They're not getting a consistent and comprehensive orientation to those topics and those issues. And I don't know how to resolve it, but it's something that I'm prepared to try to commit my time and what expertise I have to coming up with a solution to that. Thank you.
Fantastic. Any other comments or questions? All right, hearing none, we will move to agenda item number 10. And that's going to be the discussion and consideration of possible action regarding application for ECCC and licensure for Dr. Quentin Brown. Dr. Malott, you are the lead for this application. Are you able
to? Yeah, you know, I really think we need to review this in application review committee. This is more than sometimes we will move items when things are missing, so we can do a good review of this application, but this is a lot of information. So I don't know, you know, if somebody's missing a signature or something, we then say, okay, let's just do it. You know, we'll get that signature and we'll go ahead with the review. But, you know, here we have logs to look at. So I don't know, what do you feel, Dr. Caterina? Because we asked for all this information, and typically then, given the amount of information, and it wasn't the board's staff fault or anything, he had not submitted his materials, you know, and it's a lot of people look at logs and the contract, and I don't know, I'm just trying to, we sometimes will do it when we lack a quorum, and maybe I'm being difficult, so I don't like being difficult, but I don't know, Dr. Caterina.
Dr. Caterino, you are muted.
I think that it would be okay to take it back to the ARC committee, Dr. Millett.
Yeah, because we need to look at all those hours and add it up, and because this was not submitted, and I appreciate Ms. Folks' detailed notes. You know, logs were not received, so the two times we do this kind of quick review is when we have a very minor thing missing or we lack quorum, and so we need the quorum. So this, I think, would be more suited for the application review committee, where we kind of really delve into each applicant record. So
is that a motion, Dr. Malott?
Yes, my motion is to move it back to the application review committee for, you know, a substantive review before bringing it back to this full board for approval.
I'll second that.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries. All right, the time is now 8:45, so we can begin with our timed items. We'll be moving to agenda item number 7, discussion, consideration, possible action relating to initial case reviews. We will start with 7A, complaint 2208 concerning Dr. Alicia Abby Garcia. I'm the lead and I will provide a brief summary to the board. On September 25th, 2021, board staff received a complaint by fax. The complainant filed the complaint regarding Dr. Garcia's sworn testimony in her family court case that took place on September 22nd, 2021. In this complaint, she alleges that Dr. Garcia provided testimony regarding two letters that she had wrote on behalf of father and relayed that she had been father's treating provider since 2011. For nearly 8 years, and due to a noted condition in our medical condition that's in our documentation, father has only had supervised visits with son, who is now 8 years old. He has been noted multiple times by visitation supervisor that father is unable to diffuse son's tantrums, administer medications, or establish boundaries and rules, resulting in continued supervised visit recommendations for safety purposes. In a letter dated January 30th, 2020, Dr. Garcia stated that the past 4+ years, father has maintained a loving relationship with son, and it is her professional opinion that father is able to have unsupervised visits with son. It is believed by the complaint that Dr. Garcia acted outside of her scope of practice by making the opinion and recommendations in this case without doing due diligence, which may potentially place the son in danger. She alleges that Dr. Garcia was not a court-appointed evaluator in the course, nor was she asked by the court to be given or give recommendations on parenting time and decision-making authority, and feels that it is not appropriate for Dr. Garcia to make such recommendations when she has only seen the father in a treatment capacity for a total of 6 hours in 1 year. She states that Dr. Garcia has never been present for any of the father's visitations with son over the past 7 years and has never actually met the son. Additionally, Dr. Garcia has never spoken to the visitation supervisor, the complainant, son's physician, or the previously appointed court advisor and best interest attorney in order to gain knowledge of the case and concerns related to father's parenting and parenting son in an unsupervised manner. MG, the complainant, provided additional information related to her understanding of dad's compliance to treatment and criminal proceedings. MG also alleges that father has stated that he enjoys the current arrangement regarding visits and that his parents met with the father's attorney without his knowledge to file the current motion to modify parenting time. The licensee did respond in a timely fashion, providing a 2-page response via her attorney, Ms. Sarah Sturks. Dr. Garcia began providing therapy to the father in November of 2011 after he was referred to Dr. Garcia by another provider. At the time Dr. Garcia began treating father, he was not yet married to the complainants, but they did subsequently marry. Following the divorce, Dr. Garcia continued to treat father and they maintained a trusting therapeutic relationship. On January 30th, 2020, at the request of the father's attorney, Dr. Garcia wrote a letter which detailed the status of the father's therapy and treatment progress based on her 9 years of work with him. Dr. Garcia provided father's clinical records with the response, but it did not contain any information or documentation related to her testimony. In response to the staff's request for such documentation, her attorney, Sarah Stark, provided a supplemental statement on January 12th of 2022 that indicated that she should not offer any opinions about anything other than treatment and observations she has made with treating her client. In addition, on September 22nd, 2021, Dr. Garcia testified about father's treatment during a modification hearing. Dr. Garcia did not recall everything that was stated during the hearing, but she generally provided information regarding father's treatment frequency and compliance with treatment recommendations and treatment progress. And that concludes my summary. Let me move back over. We will first hear from the complainant, MG, if she is in attendance today. MG, are you present?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. And please only use initials, and we cannot discuss confidential medical information. So as you do speak, if you could refrain from discussing confidential medical information, that would be great. If we need to discuss that, we can go into executive session. If you'd like to make a statement at this time, you
No, ma'am.
Thank you, ma'am. Firstly, I would like to thank the board for hearing my complaint. I am very concerned with Dr. Garcia's actions, as they potentially were out of her scope of practice, as said, and could have placed my son in mentally, emotionally, and physically dangerous situation. To my knowledge, my ex-husband has been diagnosed with 3 different psychiatric disorders, placing him as serious mental illness. Dr. Garcia was asked by my ex testify on my ex-husband's behalf in our ongoing custody case. During this hearing, Dr. Garcia gave her professional opinion that my ex-husband should have my 8-year-old son for unsupervised visitation. Dr. Garcia based this professional opinion on 6 visits within the years. She's not been in the presence of my child, spoken to him, met him, nor been witness to any interaction between him and his father. To prepare for her testimony and professional recommendation, she did not speak with me, my son, or the visitation supervisor to familiarize herself with the relationship and events during visitation. She testified to this fact and the fact that she was not aware that my ex-husband had missed several appointments for his medication injections. She also testified that she was not aware of continued behavioral issues and questionable parenting decisions made by my ex-husband during visitation. She was not aware of incidents that had happened as late as this summer prior to her testimony, in which my son could have been injured by knives. During Dr. Garcia's own clinical documentation, she noticed that my ex-husband appeared too agitated or anxious with slurred speech during every visit. My concern is, how did she come to this professional opinion that my son should be with his father unsupervised? It seems she based the statement during a 6-hour period by a patient that had been diagnosed with his own illness. It's my belief that she did not do her due diligence in making this professional opinion, nor should she have opined in a custody case, as she was not asked to do a custody evaluation. She was only asked to give her opinion on my ex-husband's mental state. Dr. Garcia and her attorney have stated that this complaint has caused her great mental anguish, and she herself even stated in the preliminary hearing with the board that her actions were wrong. My young child is vulnerable, as he has his own behavioral diagnosis. He needs guidance, rules, stability, and protection, all of which has been documented on several occasions by several other professionals that my ex-husband is incapable of providing on his own at this time, and maybe not ever. This was a concern that the judge even commented on after witnessing my ex-husband's behavior and demeanor during his own testimony in the very same hearing Dr. Garcia testified in. I understand Dr. Garcia is upset by my complaint. I wonder, however, if it would equal the anguish I would have felt if the judge had taken her professional opinion and awarded unsupervised 50-50 custody to my ex-husband, resulting in my son being hurt or worse, due to her careless, reckless, and dangerous recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, MG. Do any board members have any questions for MG? Hearing none, do you have Dr. Garcia and her attorney present? Do you wish to make a statement? If so, please unmute yourselves and introduce yourselves and then proceed with your statement.
Yes, thank you. This is Sarah Stark, and I am counsel for Dr. Garcia. I'm going to make a very brief statement, and then I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Garcia, and she's going to make a statement as well, if that's okay. So although in this situation, it was Dr. Garcia's intent to only provide a clinical statement regarding the client's treatment and progress, she acknowledges that she offered an opinion about visitation without having the necessary data and forensic experience to objectively make that recommendation. She's acknowledged this error, and, you know, she's taken several corrective actions to make sure that she understands her role and the rules, and that this is not going to happen again in her practice. We've highlighted those in our supplemental response, and I'll just briefly go through those. She's updated her informed consent form to indicate she does not provide forensic or investigative work and does not provide legal testimony in individual or family matters. In the event she is subpoenaed to provide testimony and is legally obligated to respond, Dr. Garcia has formulated a plan to consult with colleagues that are familiar with these types of proceedings and providing forensic testimony to ensure that any opinion or testimony that she's giving is within the scope of her expertise and competence. She has completed 6 hours of continuing education in risk management, and she has reviewed the AFCC's guidelines for court-involved therapy and the APA's specialty guidelines for forensic psychology, and will continue to keep herself updated on these subjects and guidelines in the event this issue should arise in her future practice. And at this time, I'll turn it over to Dr. Garcia, who would like to make a brief statement to the board members as well.
Thank you. I have been in practice for 20 years without incident or disciplinary action of any kind. I have done a lot of reflection over the last 6 months that this complaint has been ongoing, and I am using this as a learning opportunity that will make me a better practitioner. The reason I offered an opinion, even though I should not have, is because I started therapy with this client 10 years ago before his marriage and divorce. There was never any personal or dual relationship with this client outside of the clinical treatment that was provided. His treatment had and has been progressing over the 10 years of clinical therapy. I had information only provided by my client because I was the treating psychologist. I truly believe that what he was telling me was accurate based on my clinical judgment. I have never before, provided an opinion on custody, and I am fully aware I should have not provided an opinion in this case as well. The reason I did was because there was nothing that I ever heard or observed in the 10 years of therapy that was predictive of my client being of harm to his son or danger. If I truly thought there was any risk to the child, I would never have made the recommendation, which I should not have. I still should not have given an opinion on supervision or custody time because I never met the child or any other member of the family or parties to these proceedings. In rendering my opinion, I believe that I did not use my best professional judgment in opining about custody. I assumed that the judge in this modification for supervision hearing would be weighing my testimony against all other facts in the case. I was very naive in that thinking. It is obvious that consultation with a colleague that does forensic, divorce, custody, or family work would have guided me through this in a much more professional way. In the future, when commanded by subpoena to testify, I will consult with colleagues that specialize in family custody cases and have established that relationship already. I will only discuss my treatment of patient and their progress in therapy. I will offer no opinions on custody or supervision. I will make sure to qualify all my statements in my testimony or written statement with the fact that I am only providing information based on my therapeutic work with that client. As Ms. Stark also suggested, I've done additional things by updating my informed consent. We've always pre-screened in my office and let clients know that I do not do forensic or investigative or legal testimony, but we now have it in writing in our informed consent. I have completed 6 hours of the continuing risk management education. I have reviewed and am aware of the resources and guidelines of the APA, the board, and the Association of Family Conciliation Courts. And I am very aware of the mistakes that I have made, and I assure you that I will not make the same mistakes again. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Garcia. Do we have any questions for Dr. Garcia?
I do.
Dr. Caterina?
Dr. Garcia, you said you looked at the APA guidelines. Did you look at the custody guidelines and the parenting guidelines? There are separate guidelines related to custody evaluation?
Yes, yes.
Okay. And then in terms of You said you have never before done any of these kind of letters. Is that, you mean just with this case or with any cases, or have you, had there been previous comments on this particular case in terms of custody?
Yes.
Okay, so you mean that this never before done it outside of this case. Is that what you meant?
Correct.
Okay. The other thing I was looking at is, I don't know if this is not in the complaint, but it was a lot of confusion on the diagnoses, and including one diagnosis that has been out of the DSM since 2013 that you listed in 2021. So I wondered if you might want to review some psychopathology diagnoses to just be sure you're using current.
I know that was sloppiness on my part in terms of not just updating that diagnosis to the new guidelines.
Right. And then the other one where there's controversy between you and other providers. And then sometimes you're using one that the others providers are using and sometimes you're not. I can't say them, but I think you know what I mean. There's a confusion,
yes, exactly,
there. So you may want to also review some of that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. For now, I'll stop there.
Madam Chair, I have some questions, if I may ask.
Yes, Mr. Diner.
Thank you. And thank you for being here, Dr. Garcia.
Thank you.
So my question is in regards to the letter that you wrote to Attorney Jeffrey Zurbriggen. It's dated January 30th, 2020, in which he said that the father is able to have unsupervised visits with his son. So that's the letter I'm going to ask you questions about. What were the circumstances of that letter? What prompted you to write it? Was it by invitation of an attorney, or was it on the suggestion of the father?
The father asked and told me that he was being asked by his attorney whether or not I could write a letter with regard to the therapeutic work he had done with me. And I at that time, I told him you need to sign an authorization for release of information, and then your attorney could speak with me and we could, get into that. I was hoping at that point that that would be the end of it. However, it was not. The attorney did get a hold of me, asked for the letter, and then I supplied the letter.
Thank you. So as a point of clarification for the record, the letter was written to the mother's attorney then?
No, it was written to my client's attorney.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for that clarification. That's all the questions I have.
Thank you. Do we have additional questions? All right, hearing none, we will move into discussion and deliberation of this case. As the lead, I will start the discussion. I am appreciative of Dr. Garcia's words and statements today as far as acknowledging where wrongdoing has occurred. I think that's sometimes barrier number one is to just see that, yes, we do make mistakes. I think the challenge for me in particular, and I believe that I stated this in the complaint review as well, is that the significance of potential harm that could have occurred here is quite substantial. Where it may have been sloppy or misunderstanding, or somebody could have been significantly hurt. And so for me, I think if we're looking just at whether or not there was violations of the statute or standards of practice, I think that those are present. And I think we have to acknowledge and consider actions on how we move forward with the next steps. Now, this is an initial case review. And so I think that leaves us, and Ms. Galvin can clarify if I'm wrong, but that leaves us the options of you know, proposing some considerations around kind of a consent agreement, or we can move forward with the informal, that's the next step.
Correct. You could, if you believe that there are potential violations, refer this matter to the next step for the investigative hearing. And in the interim, you could authorize myself and Ms. Stark to negotiate a possible consent agreement for the board's consideration in lieu of the investigative hearing.
Thank you. So then I would turn to my psychology colleagues as far as looking at what sorts of considerations we would have for a discussion of potential consent agreement.
So are you talking about what violations or just what consequences?
We would have to list both. I do believe in the complaint screening, we have a list of violations identified as well. Ms. Michelson, while I toggle over to that other page, do you want to read those?
Sure, yeah. The violations forwarded by the CSC are on page 9. I think there were 3. The first one was 16G, which is engaging or offering to engage as a psychologist in activities not congruent with the psychologist's professional education, training, or experience. The second violation mentioned was 16O, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards of practice. And the last violation cited was 16DD, an ethical code violation. There were a few different sections, section 2.01, boundaries of competence, 3.05, multiple relationships, and 9.01, basis for assessment.
Yeah. I agree with those. I'm not sure if there was competency, if there had been education in this area or not. We'd have to find out. But the do multiple relationships, I noticed that Dr. Garcia said that she did not have a dual relationship with the client. But if you look at it in the broader sense, you had a therapeutic relationship and an custody evaluation role. So that those were two different relationships. They're two different roles. And so there, I believe there is a violation of multiple relationships in that term, in that way.
This is Ramona. I'm not as convinced about the multiple relationships. She performed a duty that she was not competent. I mean, I think of multiple relationships as, you know, having other relationships. So
it was a therapeutic relationship with the father.
Yeah.
And a custody evaluation with the child and father.
And so, but I'm still not convinced, you know, it was she performed a duty that she wasn't fully trained for. And that, to me, is a underlying issue. So
I think we need to find out what competencies and background Dr. Garcia has in terms of parenting and custody. There may be things that we don't know about.
And go ahead, Dr. Meyer.
Dr. Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. She said this was not her area of expertise in doing forensic evaluations. Mm-hmm. And she did not... she did not intentionally perform a custody evaluation. She overstepped her bounds on making that one statement. But I agree that, well, I agree with Dr. Mott that I don't think this is a multiple relationships issue. It was merely that she said something that she shouldn't have, which goes to the competency the basis for assessment ethical violation I think is also relevant here.
Well, I see it putting herself in an evaluative role given that statement, but that's okay.
Thank you, Dr. Hatter. And Ms. Shree.
I would agree with Dr. Malott and Dr. Myers. I don't see it as a multiple relationship situation. All I just believe she overstepped her role. I would agree with that.
Mr. Jenner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also agree with Dr. Mulott and Dr. Meyer in this instance, because, you know, in my mind, it wasn't clear to me when I reviewed the case file who Jeffrey Zurbriggen was. I mean, was he an attorney for the mother or the father? And with that clarification that we received today, I don't think this was a situation where Dr. Garcia was advocating a position to someone else and affecting, you know, the mother's or the child's, or maybe assessing the mom or the child in any way in making a recommendation to the attorney for the father. So I mean, in my mind, there isn't a multiple relationships issue there, but I may be wrong. You guys are the experts.
Well, and Mr. Diner, I generally, and I believe that we spoke at the CSC, if my memory serves me right, I also brought up the multiple relationships and Dr. Meyer Dr. Meyer was really thorough in kind of analyzing whether or not he felt that applied and walked me through why it didn't. The part for me that stands out a little bit different from what you're saying, Mr. Diner, just a little bit, I agree with the letter. My concern is then the oral testimony, the verbal testimony that occurred as part of the hearing, because that could have, and fortunately it did not, but that could have influenced the decision. And that's kind of I agree, it's not a multiple relationship issue. I think it's an overstepping a boundaries of competence, scope of competence issue, but it's a very dangerous one at that. And so I agree, and that's you know, the one piece that I saw there.
I agree with you, and I don't, because it is, but it is multiple roles. Not that she has a relationship with the mother as well as the father, but her role definition overlaps between therapeutic provider and evaluator. And I definitely looked at the court's testimony. That's what I agree with that.
I think she definitely overstepped in her recommendations, and we've seen that happen. You know, you have a therapeutic, and to make that reference to, you can have unsupervised, you know, without doing the full investigation, is dangerous. And so definitely I see a competency violation, you know, kind of overstepping, because we have to be very careful when we make very decisions that can have, you know, great implications. And, you know, psychologists, the courts listen to psychologists. And so, but I'm also really pleased that Dr. Garcia she's indicated great awareness of how she overstepped, and she's taking actions to remedy those, and has learned from this incident. And so I think really at this point, I think our discussion should focus on, does it need to move to an informal hearing? My sense is yes, but maybe we can do a consent agreement, and we need to also discuss the terms of the consent agreement. If this is a violation, then I think Ms. Galvin would say it has to go beyond the letter of concern, but we can say, I don't know. So I think that's what I'm hoping we can continue to discuss. So.
I just make one last statement on this, please.
And Dr. Katerina.
If you, what I was looking at, and I have it here, is the APA guidelines for child custody. And they list, let me bring that up here. They list multiple relationships as having different roles. They have a section. So this is the APA guidelines on child custody. If I don't know if you would need to look at it, but it says, hold on, I'm scrolling up. So it has point 7, psychologists strive to avoid conflicts of interest and multiple relations in conducting evaluations. And they take on that you have to have this would be a problem with impaired impartiality, or where you have a professional role with one person when you're making this decision. So this is why I said that. You may want to look at that for the future then. It's it's guidelines for child custody evaluations and family law proceedings by the APA.
Thank you, Dr. Catarino. Ms. Shreve.
Thank you. You know, in some ways, I think that she wasn't necessarily doing a child custody evaluation. She stepped out of her lane. And so I think that she fell in that lane, but I don't know if that pertains to her, because that's not the lane she should have been. She was in. She stepped out of her area of expertise. She stepped out of a lot of other things. I think that we should move forward with a consent decree. And I think, you know, that the point is it maybe requiring a lot more training in areas of, you know, of ethics of you know, whatever we feel it that the area should be. But I think we're looking at, in my opinion, is additional training.
Yes, I agree with you, Michelle.
So I would look at the psychologist to provide what areas of training given the situation.
Thank you. Mr. Diner, and then Dr. Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I sort of have a comment in response to Dr. Catarino's mention of the guidelines for family court. So I think there are two sort of things in my mind. One is under Section 16DD of our statutes, we have only adopted the ethics rules, not the guidelines. So we are kind of only looking at the ethics rules, and the complaint screening committee had listed 2.01 boundaries of competence, 3.05 multiple relationships, 9.01 basis for assessment as possible violation. So I guess, I mean, we should be careful in not stepping beyond the things that are listed there, and we have never as a board formally adopted any guidelines issued by the Psychological Association. So I would be careful with stating that as the basis for ethical violations when that's just not what we're supposed to look at. Thank you.
Dr. Meyer.
And just to build on that, those guidelines say that a psychologist just should not take on those two roles of a therapist and evaluator, right? Dr. Garcia has not alleged to have done an evaluation. She did not say that she was doing that. She did not present to the court that she was doing a custody evaluation. None of that occurred. All that she did was make a statement that he was okay based on her input to be with the kid without supervision. That was not an evaluation. There was not a multiple role here. There was just a overzealous statement in support of her client from a therapist. No evaluation was done. So there's not a multiple role.
I was thinking though her comments to the court that in making a judgment that he would be allowed to be with the child is an evaluation, though poorly done and not doing it properly. But that statement seems like an evaluation to me.
It's a statement. It's not an evaluation. It is an opinion that she was not brought to the court to give. It was an opinion that was outside of what she had done.
Okay. All right.
So, Dr. Malott and Dr. Meyer, Dr. Catarino, do we have thoughts on what we would want to see in a consent agreement?
I thought continuing ed and in child custody, a little bit of psychopathology and diagnoses, and whatever else anybody suggests.
Yeah, I agree with Dr. Catarino. The risk management that she did is a good step, but it's not really, that's about protecting her, not about learning the boundaries of doing evaluations. So I think continuing education on the distinction between, or the the distinction between therapy and evaluation, forensic evaluation would be my recommendations.
I would also recommend maybe 4 hours of consultation with a forensic psychologist, maybe somebody that the board chooses. We have a couple that are very, very well versed in these issues. I'm thinking of Dr. DeBacco and others. So I think that would really help Dr. Garcia understand the nuances. So maybe, you know, having that intensive peer kind of supervision, not supervision, but kind of, you know, I've learned a lot from my fellow psychologists. So.
Are you saying like just not
like a consultation, you know, maybe for
where she would need to meet and talk with them
for, and document, like, yeah,
mm-hmm. and learn about forensics like for four times an hour each? Is that what you're referring to? Something like that?
Like approximately 4 hours total, you know. I think beyond that, you're going to be talking about
right. mm-hmm. Okay, I just want to make sure. I think we need to get parameters here so we can just. Yeah. Make a decision.
But we'd like a report that they have formed the psychologist, that the person has had a discussion, and that they have demonstrated understanding of the nuances.
Okay. Do we have, Mr. Diner.
Yeah, just a final point of clarification. So I'm thinking of this as a non-disciplinary consent agreement. Just wanted to mention that and see what the other members think.
Just to clarify, I believe if it's a non-disciplinary order that there are no violations, and I'm not sure, I would like clarification from Ms. Galvin, but I'm not sure if we can add consultation to a non-disciplinary order. Ms. Galvin?
Correct. I believe that the board has determined that there are violations, so typically that comes with discipline and would not result in a non-disciplinary consent agreement. If you fashion an order that would involve disciplinary CE in the distinction between therapy and forensic evaluations and diagnosis and psychopathology, I think you could add the consultation feature, but I would be reluctant to order term this non-disciplinary when I believe that it is clear from the discussion that the board has found violations.
So what you're saying, Ms. Galvin, is the non-disciplinary kind of letter of concern with CE is only offered in the case where we had concern and we did not see a full-fledged violation.
Correct.
Thank you, Dr. Malott. Thank you, Ms. Galvin. Mr. Dinar, did that answer your question?
Yes, it did. I mean, it answered the question in the sense that, yeah, that's sort of what our statutes require us to do. But in my mind, I think there are mitigating factors. You know, Dr. Garcia seems to have taken steps going forward to change how she evaluates or how she looks at these sort of situations. Of course, that doesn't quite answer Dr. Meyer's question as to, you know, what sort of steps Dr. Garcia could have taken to protect the child in this case. And so, I mean, in that sense, it's because there are mitigating factors in my mind, it is non-disciplinary as opposed to disciplinary.
Thank you. All right. And did we land on an actual number of CE hours that we would be recommending?
I did not hear any specific numbers or the time frame within which all of this should be completed.
I would say about 10 and maybe 6 months. Is that okay, Ms. Shreve? I know you brought it up too. So
I think that's great. Do you want to identify that you said of the 10, 4 hours is with consultation with the forensic psychologist? And then how would the other hours be split out? The other
I think with assessment, diagnosis, and child custody evaluations.
So that would be then 3 assessment, evaluation, and 3 child custody?
Yes.
Okay. So you want to make that motion?
And just to clarify, would this be, these 10 hours be allowed for renewal or no?
No.
I would say no.
Excuse me, did you say 3 assessment, 3 child custody, and then 4 consultation?
Maybe we should do, okay.
Okay, I just wanted to, if I heard it correctly, thank you.
So I'll make a motion that we move forward with a consent decree with a 4 hours of consulting with a forensic psychologist, after which we'd want a report from this forensic psychologist that it had occurred and that they felt that it was a learning experience. 3 hours of assessment, diagnosis, and 3 hours of child custody, and to be completed within 6 months. That's my motion.
If I may, and this is a CE that would not be counted toward her CE that's required for renewal. Yeah. I heard Dr. Meyer suggested maybe some sort of CE where there would be a distinction between therapy and forensic evaluation. If she, and I'm trying to get this in my mind, if she isn't going to practice in the forensic area, I'm not going to make recommendations to the court. CE and child custody, how is that going to kind of address the issue? I like Dr. Meyer's, suggestion that we have a distinction between therapy and child custody, but to require 3 hours in child custody in an area she isn't going to practice in, shouldn't be practicing in, has stated she's not going to be practicing in, why are we going to have her take 3 hours in that?
Maybe it needs to be kind of, maybe we could term it broadly in terms of psychological evaluations and the nuances of the different types. Sometimes it's difficult to find those very nuanced recommendations that we make. That's why I like the consultation, because I think you learn a lot more from somebody who's more experienced, not going to find one that is so nuanced.
Right. I think that the consultation with a forensic psychologist is, the focus is on making that distinction between what should and should not occur, what crosses over into forensic psychology, right? Mm-hmm. And if that's 4 hours, then we have the 3 hours on diagnosis and psychopathology, and then 3 hours on psychological assessment.
More broadly defined.
All right, so I'll amend my motion to take out the child custody and add, Dr. Meyer, you said psychological evaluation?
Yeah.
Okay, and so amend it with that. That's my motion. Within 6 months, and it does not count towards regular CEs.
And the consultation provider would be pre-approved by the board. Do you want the CE pre-approved by the board?
Yes. That would be my motion too.
Seconded.
And then if they agree to the consent agreement, it'll come back to the board for approval and we can vacate the informal hearing.
Perfect.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing, Mr. Diamond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, while I agree with sort of the direction of the motion, I just wanted to state for the record that I do not see anything in the statutes that requires us to offer a disciplinary agreement in this instance. In my mind, there are mitigating factors, and I would have not, made this disciplinary. I would have made it non-disciplinary. So I just wanted to state that for the record. So, in other words, if our statutes required us to take disciplinary action, we had no option, that would be a different matter. But here, I don't see, unless I'm wrong, tell me if I'm wrong. I don't see anything in the statutes that requires taking disciplinary action in these sort of situations. Thank you.
Yes,
Dr. Mala?
I see where Mr. Diner is coming from, and especially where there's such awareness of, you know, kind of the overstepping. I don't know. Is it possible maybe to go into executive session and get advice from Ms. Galvin on that point?
Is that a motion?
Yes.
I'll second it.
A motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. We can go to the breakout room. Welcome back, everybody. We currently have a motion on the table by Ms. Shreve, seconded by Dr. Malott. We were having discussion.
I don't know if I seconded it. I'm not sure. I don't think we seconded the motion.
We did. We went into discussion.
Yeah, it was seconded.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it may not have been you. You're correct. It may not have been okay. But but it, I believe that it was.
I think I did.
Okay. Thank you, Doctor. And I think you are correct. So okay. We have a motion and a second. We were in discussion. Ms. Shreve, Dr. Meyer, do you have additional discussion?
Could Ms. Shreve repeat her motion? Because I know we talked a lot about the CE portion, but maybe the first part of the motion. I'm very clear on the CE's recommendation.
I can repeat it based on my notes, if that would help.
Thank you, Ms. Galvin.
So this would be a consent agreement for disciplinary CE, 3 hours of CE in diagnoses, psychopathology, and 3 hours in psychological assessment. The CEs would not count towards the renewal of her license. There will also be 4 hours required with a forensic psychologist to act in a consultative role. And this would have to be done within
6 months.
I believe, yes, 6 months. The CE and the consultant would be pre-approved by the board. This would be set for an informal hearing that can be vacated if the consent agreement is signed.
And was there consensus, though, on which violations? I know I was arguing that it was not multiple relationships, but Dr. Caterino was saying there was. So what violations are part of this motion?
The violations I had were 16G, O, D, D, and based on the discussion, 201 and 901, 9.01, 2.01.
Do you mind kind of specifying the...
2.01 is competency and 9.01 is basis for assessment.
Okay.
Well, if you're saying that she didn't conduct an evaluation, then there was no assessment.
No, she made a recommendation as part of the assessment that she wrote. You know, her recommendation was
That's my argument. It doesn't have to be yours. Even if I get really aggressive about it.
It seemed like maybe competency was the main one.
I'm good with that. You know, I think competency, really practicing outside the boundaries of a competence. So
just 2.01?
Yeah.
Well, that's my opinion. Again, I don't know what everybody else thinks.
Dr. Meyer, I know you've been...
Yeah, I think competency fits. The only one I was saying I didn't see is multiple relationships.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we had a motion and we voted on it.
We did not vote.
Wouldn't that be part of the motion? The specific
and this, really, this is just a motion to give us some direction on a consent agreement. You're going to review the consent agreement before it's finalized. This is just sort of guidance to me to discuss the case and try to get some resolution with Ms. Stark and Dr. Garcia.
Do we decide now if it's disciplinary or non-disciplinary?
Motion at this point is disciplinary. So we do have to take action on the motion. Dr. Malott just asked for a repeat of the motion. So, we do have a motion. We do have a second. We have received clarification in the form of reciting the motion. So we do need to vote. It is the motion is disciplinary. So we do have a roll call that we will need to take. Ms. Pacnon, can you call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Dr. Catarino?
Yes.
Mr. Diner?
My vote is no, and my explanation is that disciplinary is not warranted and not supported by the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Dr. Malak?
I think I'm going to go with a no vote too, for the same reasons.
Ms. Shreve?
Yes.
And Mr. Nguyen?
No.
5 yes votes, 3 no votes. The motion does not pass.
It does not?
I have the motion does carry.
The majority is yes.
The majority is yes. The motion passes.
I beg your pardon. I was looking for 6 votes. Thank you.
Yes. So we'll work on a consent agreement. If they are willing to enter it, we'll have it to you before the next meeting. It'll also be set for an informal that can be vacated if we reach a resolution. Ms. Stark will be in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we will now move to the next item.
Madam Chair, if I apologize for interrupting, I want to give the next the code word for continuing education credit. For those in attendance today, the first code word is Earth Day. Again, the code word is Earth Day. Thank you.
Earth Day. Thank you, Ms. Michelson. All right, we will now move to item 7B, complaint number T2205, Dr. Gloria Malone. Ms. Shreve, you are the lead for this case. Will you please provide a brief summary to the board?
Yes, one moment. Okay, thank you. If you can hear me. Dr. Malone was issued her psychologist license by the board in 1984. In 2019, the board received a complaint from Dr. Malone's client. And based upon the complaint, Dr. Malone ultimately decided to sign a consent agreement that surrendered her license. The consent agreement was effective July 12, 2019. Dr. Malone was 73 years old at the time of the surrender of her license. Approximately 2.5 years later, after the surrender, the board received an email from an individual who indicated that Dr. Malone had responded to a post on Nextdoor, which is an app that connects neighbors, in which a neighbor required for therapy referral. In Dr. Malone's December 26, 2021 reply, she stated that the person seeking assistance, that she was a psychologist and was welcoming new patients to her office. We received a response from Dr. Malone. And the response said that we received a response from Dr. Malone through her attorney, Mr. Harry Howell. Mr. Howell stated Dr. Malone does not hold herself out as a licensed psychologist. She is not practicing psychologist. She did not realize that even though with all of her education and degrees and training that she can no longer refer to herself as a psychologist. Immediately upon the board staff complaint notification letter, Dr. Malone just continued referring to herself as a psychologist. Dr. Malone is fully in compliant now with ARS 322084 and is not practicing psychology, does not hold herself as a licensed psychologist. That Dr. Malone is in complete compliance with the statute now, and she has authorized Mr. Howe to state that she would willingly and without objection agree to enter into a cease and desist order should the board feel it's appropriate. Upon receiving their response, our board staff responded back to them asking the following. Why was Dr. Malone offering her services in response to the Nextdoor post inquiring about therapy referral when she surrendered her license? Why did Dr. Malone not reply to the question on Nextdoor, the thread inquiring about her status of her license? Why has Dr. Malone not yet deleted her Nextdoor post, which at this point she has? And how many clients has Dr. Malone seen at her practice since surrendering her license in 2019? And that for them to provide a list of those clients and the date service. We received another response to those questions from Mr. Howell on March 4th. Mr. Howell stated that Dr. Malone is 75 years old and is in frail health. She was not able to attend today's meeting or the CSC because of that. That Dr. Malone does not hold herself out as a licensed psychologist. She's not practicing psychology, and she did not understand that she was prohibited from using the word psychologist. The post on Nextdoor has been deleted, as well as her profile on Nextdoor. And the specific questions about clients were not addressed in their response. And that concludes my summary.
Thank you, Ms. Shreve. We do not have a complainant, as the board staff is who opened this complaint in response to an email inquiry that they received from a member of the public. We do not have Dr. Malone with us. However, we do have her attorney, Mr. Harry Howe, present. Mr. Howe, would you like to introduce yourself? And if you would like to, you can make a brief statement to the board. And you will have to unmute yourself.
Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Harry Howe, and I am the attorney for Dr. Malone. I would not normally, ladies and gentlemen, make a presentation, but Ms. Michelson did ask that I address a couple of questions, and so I'm going to do that. One of the questions was, what efforts had been undertaken to take down any internet presence of Dr. Malone? Initially, it was this Nextdoor communication, the only communication she's ever had on Nextdoor. Dr. Malone's husband, whose name is Dennis, is almost 80 years old. He spent a day and a half himself trying to get it down, and it was ultimately taken down. They're not computer savvy individuals. Ms. Michelson, maybe a week to 10 days ago, I'm not exactly sure, also sent me a post, a Google type presence that listed Dr. Malone. And I myself tried to amend that. And the only thing that I was able to actually get accomplished was an edit which said permanently closed. So in addition to those efforts, I met with a computer systems engineer who does my IT work. His name is Mike Callenberg. And I asked him, what can we do to get this information if the board wanted more off? I want you to understand, Dr. Malone, to her knowledge, has never created an internet presence. These are presences like WebMD, Find a Top Doc, some that I've never even heard of. And Mr. Callenberg said, it's difficult. It probably can be done, but it takes time to get that done. But the fact simply is Dr. Malone had no part in any of those presences other than Nextdoor. So the old saying that Mr. Callenberg told me, that what goes onto the internet, be careful what you say, because it generally stays on the internet. And I don't know exactly how that is true for some of these search platforms, but we have done what we can do. The question was also asked, when did Dr. Malone stop seeing patients? When she surrendered her license, she stopped seeing patients. However, from the time that she had an office on 71st Way, an actual office before she moved home, she had some patients, and after she surrendered her license, she was contacted by a few of those and asked if they could come over to her home and talk to her, and she unwisely agreed. She has always told these folks and reminded these folks that she is not a licensed psychologist. It's very, very few people. I do not have an exact number, but she has seen very few people. But she did see some people in her home, and it was basically conversation. I'm not going to be semantical with you. She has been her entire adult life a clinical psychologist, and she was unwisely talking with these people. After receiving the letter from the board, and she contacted me, she immediately contacted those few people and said she could no longer even speak with them. Not at all, not anymore, ever. And she gave several who requested a referral to a separate healthcare provider. Lastly, since surrendering her license, she has never referred to herself as a licensed psychologist. As I mentioned, she's always told and reminded anybody that was talking to her that she no longer had a license. In fact, when she surrendered her license, she and her husband destroyed all of her letterhead, business cards, anything that referenced being a licensed psychologist. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'll try as best I can to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Ms. Shreve.
Yes, Mr. Howell, when she was meeting with these individuals for conversation, was she accepting payments for that?
She did accept the people offered to pay her, and she accepted a very reduced fee. There were no insurance billings or anything like that. But if somebody offered to pay her, she would take it, but it was on a very reduced basis.
And was she providing counseling? What was she doing?
that's outside of my area, Ms. Shreve. She's been a psychologist most of her adult life. The people that did ask to come over and talk with her were people who had been patients of hers when she was practicing psychology.
Okay.
It was basically, as she told me, relationship type discussions. And so the question was she practicing psychology, I'm just not qualified to actually address that.
All right. Thank you.
You bet.
Dr. Catarino, did you have
That was my question. So fine. Thank you.
Dr. Meyer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Howe. Was she keeping clinical records on an ongoing basis for these?
Dr. Meyer, she took notes as she was talking with the people.
And she still has these?
I certainly advised her immediately that nothing should be destroyed.
Okay. Thank you.
Do we have any additional questions? Thank you, Mr. Howe. The board will now move into discussion and deliberation. Ms. Shreves, do you have?
I'd be happy to. Thank you. Just a quick question for Ms. Galvin. She's no longer licensed by us. So there's really, I definitely think a cease and desist order is needed. But I think as far as any kind of penalty, she's no longer licensed. So I don't think we have direct ability. Is that correct?
Yeah, the first step in something like this would be a cease and desist. And I understand from Mr. Howe that she will consent to the entry of a cease and desist.
Then I think we should do a cease and desist order, and I would make a motion for that.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Seconded.
Motion and second. Any further discussion? All in favor? Do we need a roll call for that, Ms. Galvin?
No.
All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed?
I'm not opposed.
Thank you, Mr. Diner. The motion does carry. Mr. Howe, thank you very much for joining us today and for answering our questions. We do appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen.
All right. We will now move to item number 8. This is going to be the discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to the initial case review of complaint number 2207 against Dr. Jerry Gentry and her pending, as well as her pending renewal application.
Madam Chair, is it possible just before we start this one, as I feel it might be a little bit longer, can we just have a convenience break for maybe 5-10 minutes, maybe?
Yes, we may. Let's do 10 minutes. Is everybody okay with that?
Thank you.
Yeah. I think we can forward. Just Dr. Malott, have you joined again? Dr. Malott, just one moment.
Madam Chair, she had indicated to me that there may be a 15-minute window of time where she may have to step out of the meeting. So perhaps she did so in this instance. I'm not certain.
Okay. Then let's go ahead and take a look at agenda item number 9. Just in case she's a little bit late to join us, since that is a behavior analyst matter, we can see that one first. All right, agenda item number 9, discussion, consideration, possible action relating to the Committee on Behavior Analysis or Analyst recommendation regarding the following complaints. We have complaint number T2204, Kristen Jones. I am the lead on this matter, and so I will provide a summary of the case. Ms. Jones came forth as a name of a supervisor for an applicant who was applying for licensure. When the applicant applied for licensure, it was noted during the review process that Ms. Jones provided a couple hundred hours worth of supervision that was done outside of the Arizona licensing requirements. She is a licensed behavior analyst in Tennessee. But not licensed in the state of Arizona. The remote supervision occurred in which the student resided here in Arizona and was providing services at a school here in Arizona. When board staff reached out to Ms. Jones, she stated that she had never practiced in Arizona and that she had no intentions to practice in Arizona. We met with Ms. Jones and her supervisor as a committee to discuss kind of the role of remote supervision and discuss our concerns, at which time the committee did request to open a complaint regarding the potential violation of practicing without a license. Ms. Jones provided was responsive to all of the board's the committee's requests, and she did come before the committee last week, of which she acknowledged that she now understood that licensure was required, and she did acknowledge that she understood the ramifications of practicing across the states without the license. After speaking with the individual and going over our concerns for those few hours, we did note that the applicant was able to get her hours completed rather quickly and was able to still get licensed. And so based on the applicant's ability to get licensed and the supervisor's quick response acknowledgement of the issues, she also acknowledged that she had not supervised anybody else in Arizona and that all of her remote supervision occurs in California, where licensure is not required. So the committee has recommended the complaint for dismissal. I believe, let me see if Ms. Jones is present.
I was invited, Madam Chair, but I do not see her here today.
Thank you. I do not see her either, but that does conclude my summary. So we will open it up then for discussion by the board. Dr. Catarino.
So I was reading some of the guidelines, and it said that an out-of-state licensed person can practice for 20 days in Arizona. So I'm wondering if the 160 hours or so that she provided supervision, I mean, of the you said a couple hundred hours of supervision she provided.
Right? Yeah.
So does that fall under the 20 days just for future reference or not?
You know, that was one of the things that we discussed as far as a potential could be. The problem is that it's still, even though we don't have a violation of practicing without a license, the supervisee is required to have a licensed supervisor. And so, so I think as far as her being able to provide remote supervision for 20 days, that would be allowable, except that if that candidate is going for supervision in or going for licensure in Arizona, then those hours don't count towards that 1500. So we were able to address and rectify that issue. She was able to document the additional hours and provide those additional hours to us. And then we were mostly wanting to have the conversation with the supervisor to ensure that there weren't additional supervisees that she was continuing to supervise remotely, and that she understood that ongoing supervision would require licensure. And so that is, all of those factors are reasons why our recommendation has come forth as a dismissal. But yes, the bigger concern is just that those hours won't count towards the supervised hours.
Okay.
Any additional questions or discussion? Do we have a motion?
I'll go ahead and make the motion for dismissal.
And I will second that. Any further discussion? All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. And we do have Dr. Malott back with us, so we will go back to item number 8. This is going to be a discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to initial case review of complaint number 2007 against Dr. Jerry Gentry and her pending renewal application. I am the lead on this matter, so I'm going to provide a summary to the board. It is going to be a lengthy summary, so please bear with me. On September 7th, 2021, board staff received MR's complaint by email as follows. On August 31st, 2021, Dr. Gentry was escorted off the prison complex by the Arizona Department of Corrections for unlawful inmate fraternization, in which personal inappropriate photos were obtained by an inmate. Dr. Gentry's employment with Centrion was contingent upon having, which was her employer, was contingent upon having the security clearance. But due to the Department of Corrections revocation of the security clearance, Dr. Gentry's employment with Centrion was terminated and she was deemed not eligible for rehire. On October 6, 2021, board staff received Dr. Gentry's complaint response in a timely manner via email, providing a detailed timeline of her account of the events that led up to her departure with her employer. She remains adamant that she was never terminated, nor was there ever any mention of unlawful inmate fraternization, as was stated in the complaint. Dr. Gentry resigned from her position because her concerns were not taken seriously. Dr. Gentry is the one who reported her concerns as soon as she became aware of them and followed the appropriate protocols for reporting SD's complaints. Dr. Gentry does say it was never determined how SD obtained the personal photographs. However, she acknowledged that the tattoos in the photographs were hers. She also stated that the photos were printed for her husband and that she had misplaced them, though she does not recall bringing them onto the complex. On December 30th, 2021, in response to board staff's request, CIU supervisors provided a copy of the Department of Corrections confidential investigative report, which includes a supplemental report by a second investigator. This information has been provided to the board. The supervisor indicated that while no criminal charges have been submitted to the county attorney's office against Dr. Gentry, but after investigation of the allegation, evidence was found to support inappropriate behavior by the doctor. Dr. Gentry had her security clearance revoked and was terminated from employment with the Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. Upon review of the investigative report, board staff sent a list of questions to Dr. Gentry regarding the allegations, as well as other questions related to her current and past employment. On February 4th, 2022, Dr. Gentry submitted a 9-page response, and those answers to those questions are presented to the board members for review. In the complaint supplemental email statement for the case, she indicated when speaking to the CIU unit today, they shared that it might be beneficial to let you know that some of the information they received during interviews and investigations included that Dr. Gentry moved to Arizona following potential reports made in California as well. It does appear that this information was provided by one of the inmates during the ADOC investigations. In board staff's review of Dr. Gentry's 2020 application for licensure with the board, it was noted that she was previously employed in different capacities from 2016 to 2019 by a company located in California called Sharper Future, which provides mental health and forensic services to various government law enforcement agencies. Dr. Gentry represents that she provided services to individuals on parole. Dr. Gentry subsequently moved to Arizona after leaving her employment with Sharper Future, stating cost of living as her reason. She answered no to the background question on the application that asks about previous employment terminations. Board staff sent a subpoena to Sharper Future for Dr. Gentry's complete employment record. Their attorney stated that they were unable to comply with the subpoena in light of a California law that governs those employee records. So board staff sent Dr. Gentry a list of questions pertaining to her employment at Sharper Future. Dr. Gentry continued to deny any investigation, termination, or resignation in lieu of termination and indicated that an NDA was in place preventing her from sharing any further details. Board staff subsequently requested from Dr. Gentry that she sign a release form that would authorize Sharper Future to release her employment record to the board. After retaining legal counsel, Dr. Gentry did sign this form. During the initial review, the committee motioned to move forward the complaint for initial review and directed Dr. Gentry's attorney in the interim to review the non-disclosure agreement that Dr. Gentry entered into with her previous employer in California to determine if it can be released to the board. Following the CSC, an 11-page document titled Confidential Settlement Agreement and Release was provided to the board staff, though most of its content was redacted. The first page, however, makes reference to what appears to be a dispute regarding wages. In March, board staff received the employment file from her previous employer, Sharper Future. It is noted that a personnel action form dated June 12, 2019, indicated that the employee was suspended from work pending an investigation. A personal action form dated June 13th, 2019 indicated that Dr. Gentry was terminated for overfamiliarity and boundary violations. The incident was reported by a supervisee. The boundary incident was reported by a supervisee of Dr. Gentry's and alleges that Dr. Gentry had alcoholic beverages with a client and made a comment about the client being sexy. It further details what the supervisee witnessed across multiple dates, including information that the client had bought dinner for Dr. Gentry, as well as taken Dr. Gentry shopping at the outlets after seen leaving a bar together. During the course of the investigation, Dr. Gentry initially denied the allegations, but later clarified that she and the client happened to bump into each other at the restaurant and had 1 to 2 alcoholic beverages and some water, but adamantly denies that the meeting was planned or that her actions were anything but professional, even during the drinking engagement. Dr. Gentry further acknowledged that she did comment on her client's good looks, but that it was in general context of speaking about good-looking clients. It was concluded that by acknowledging that she saw a client at the bar and had an alcoholic beverage with the client, that she had engaged in the boundary violation and was thus terminated. To note, when asked in the 2020 application for licensure if Dr. Gentry had ever been terminated or resigned in lieu of termination, Dr. Gentry answered no. Further, in the renewal application before us today, Dr. Gentry has also indicated an answer of no for that same question. Yesterday, we did receive a copy of the Centrion employee file, and I'm going to ask Ms. Michelson to provide us a summary.
Yes, Madam Chair. As noted in my investigative report, I did send a subpoena to Centrion for Dr. Gentry's complete employment file beyond what was received by the complainant. I did receive that file yesterday from their attorney, which has been uploaded to your meeting materials, and I did also forward it to Dr. Gentry's attorney as well. In reviewing the file, I noted that on her employment application with Centrion, she did not list the Sharper Future employment despite the application specifically asking for the individual to list the last 10 years of employment. Furthermore, the application did ask various background questions to include, have you ever been terminated or asked to resign from a position? Dr. Gentry did check no to this question despite her employment file from Sharper Future indicating that she was terminated for a boundary violation. Dr. Gentry did sign a statement at the end of this employment application indicating that all of the information she provided is true and accurate. The board may wish to discuss if this misrepresentation may be a potential violation of 16C, which is making or using statements of a character tending to deceive or mislead. I do also want to note that while Dr. Gentry has represented to the board that she resigned from Centuron and was not terminated, her employment record, when I reviewed it, indicated otherwise. And I did also ask the attorney who had sent the employment file for clarification on this issue. Last night, he did respond to my email indicating, quote, "The file indicates that our client, the Arizona Department of Corrections, revoked her security clearance, which means she is barred from entering the facility where she worked. When that happens, since our providers have been able to get into the prisons to treat clients, we need to separate their employment. Our documentation shows that she was terminated for this reason and is ineligible for rehire. I saw nothing about a resignation," end quote. And this concludes my additional information that I wanted to provide. And just one other thing, the complainant did indicate that she would be unable to attend today and that her supervisor, SW, would be here on in case the board members have any questions, and I do see that she's here.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us, SW. If you would like to, and you don't have to, if you're here just for questions, that's okay as well. But if you would like to unmute yourself, you are welcome to introduce yourself by initials only and make a brief statement to the board.
Hi, sure. Thank you for having me. Yes, initials SW. And as Ms. Michelson said, I'm here in place of the complainant. I am familiar with the case, but I will sit back for questions. Thank you.
Board members, do we have any questions for SW? Ms. Shreve?
Yeah, one of the items that we requested were the photos that were basically the topic of this discussion, in essence. They were not provided. Do you know why they were not provided?
Madam Chair, I would like to clarify, Ms. Shreve, this was a request made to the Arizona Department of Corrections, not Centuron, as they provided the investigative report. And I did follow up again with an email asking for the photos, and I still did not receive a response back.
Yeah. All right. Sorry about that. Thanks for clarifying. Then I don't have any questions.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions for SW? Hearing none, we do...
Dr. Davis-Wilson, I was just wondering, I don't have any right now, but as we continue with discussion, could we request that SW stay on in case we have questions at that point?
Yes, SW, are you able to join us for the remainder of this agenda item?
Yes, of course.
Are you familiar, or you don't represent the Department of Corrections, so are you familiar with their the email system that's spoken of in there about the where the prisoners were writing their aunt an email? Are you familiar with that system?
Yeah, so the Centurion is a private company that works for the prison system, which is where we're employed with. Are you referring to like the system called I don't know, J-PAL? I think that's
J-PAL.
Different. I am familiar, yes, with that system. So, that's a go ahead.
Just a quick question. Do the inmates know that their J-PAL emails are read? Are they public? Are they public to the correctional employees, I guess?
Yes. There's a process that it goes through, usually through nursing, that kind of, you know, skims it and reads it and then determines, you know, where it's going to be sent. Is it a nursing issue, mental health?
No, I meant what department? I meant the emails, the personal emails that the prisoner sends to their relatives. There were emails in the packet. Are you familiar with that?
I'm sorry. I don't know if it was frozen. I didn't hear the whole.
Okay. So there are emails from a prisoner to, I believe it was an aunt, so a relative. Are those emails reviewed by correctional staff?
Yes.
Okay. And that's well known in the prison system.
Yes, they have to review, you know, all outgoing mail in whatever form, you know, you can imagine for various reasons.
Okay. I just wanted to confirm that.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Dr. Meyer?
Thank you. Thank you for being here, SW. And so from Centurion's perspective, Dr. Gentry was fired, not resigned?
Correct.
And there were some text messages, I believe, between Dr. Gentry and her supervisor at the time saying she was resigning. Were those received and made part of the personnel file?
I don't have that exact information. I believe I heard that, but I couldn't tell you the details. I want to speak on behalf of her supervisor on when or if she got those text messages. I don't see it in the file. I don't see that.
Okay. And what was the date of termination?
I thought September.
September 31st is when they pulled her clearance. 2021.
Okay. Just to clarify, Dr. Meyer, on page 36, the involuntary termination report says last day worked August 31st of 2021, and the termination date is the same date.
But was that sent out? I mean...
Yeah, that's... How was she notified?
I did not see any other documentation in the employment file that I subpoenaed. And not see a letter.
Can you share how Dr. Gentry would have been notified of her termination?
I wish it would be in the file. So there's, you know, the difference, obviously, if she, you know, being walked out versus the actual termination date, potentially. Usually, if it's not done on the spot, you know, the same day, then it would be, you know, via email. Possibly phone, but usually it's email. But I don't have that specific information. I don't know if that was, I guess it sounds like they didn't provide that.
Okay. That's all I had. Thank you.
Dr. Meyer, Dr. Davey, Madam Chair, if you go to page 36, I believe, of the larger packet, the 336, there is a summary of the termination meeting.
But is there a termination letter?
The meeting, according to this document, and I believe everybody can see it, the notice of termination was communicated in an in-person meeting. Exit package was provided to the employee. Termination had been reviewed by HR. Termination had been approved by management.
And I apologize, I'm looking at, I think this is part of a subpoena, but the termination date on here on the termination report is August 31st.
Yeah.
So you're talking about the involuntary termination report, right?
That's the one I'm looking at, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I guess the security clearance took another month to go through, but the actual termination date was August 31st.
And so this says that a in-person meeting, so would, I guess, Melanie De La Rocha would have come out somewhere to meet with Dr. Gentry?
That's the HR representative. I don't know if she... and specifically was there in person. That's not necessarily required per se.
Right, but it says it's an in-person meeting.
Meaning probably with her and her supervisor and people on at the prison site. So Melanie is just the HR rep that, okay, you know, gets involved in these things, of course. But I don't know that her in particular was there.
So is there another Centurion supervisor at the prison?
You're talking about other than Dr. Gentry's direct supervisor?
Was the direct supervisor on site? Did Dr. Gentry have a supervisor that was on site in the prison?
On August 31st, that day?
At all?
Oh, yes. Every day. Monday through Friday.
Okay. And who was that?
Am I allowed to say that?
I think. Denny Odi.
What's that?
I think Ms. Gavin nodded yes.
Yes, you are.
Oh, okay. It's Dr. Reese Williams. I think she was on
site. So I couldn't tell if she was on site or not.
She is on site, yeah, 5 days a week.
Okay.
Yeah, that's their...
I think those are all my questions. Thank you.
Dr. Meyer, if I may, I would just point you to one other, the communication Please. That follows that termination report.
Yeah.
The email that goes out that has, I believe, Dr. Williams to them stating that... Dr. Gentry had been on site and had now been escorted off.
But that didn't go to Dr. Gentry.
No, this was an internal, it looks like, just right. to Arizona Department of Corrections and Centurion that she had been escorted off, I would assume, one would assume, after this meeting with HR.
Yeah. Okay.
So there is a report by Dr. I mean, it'd be helpful to have had the doctor here. Dr. Gentry, she says, I've never been notified I was being terminated. In fact, I continue to receive emails and phone calls.
She is here.
Yep, she's here.
Oh, she's here?
Yeah, we are just at the point of
okay.
asking questions to the complainants.
Oh, okay. I do see a name. Sorry.
Yeah, and if we don't have any further questions.
I got a question.
Oh, mystery.
So just to confirm, we do not, or you do not have a letter, a document addressed to her, the doctor, regarding termination.
Mm-hmm.
Most, when you terminate someone, typically there's a documentation of it, a letter. So just to confirm, there was never, or you do not have in your file, anything that states she was terminated. Or released.
So the termination report.
But the report's a report. Usually, I mean, that's your internal report. What I'm talking about, a document that is given to the employee that says you're terminated. And here's any appeal process or any whatever it is that is in your letters. Do you have that?
I don't have that. I guess that would be, yeah, that's, I don't know if that was requested. I would assume so. But yeah, that would, you know, come from HR. So I don't know.
And I don't know. All right. Confirmed, Ms. Michelson, you did request the full personnel file, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. The subpoena was for the entire file, including all hiring documents to end of employment. And the attorney worked with HR to compile that. So everything that was received is in that file that you have.
All right. Thank you.
Any further questions for SW? All right, hearing none, we will now introduce Mr. Barber and Dr. Gentry. If Dr. Gentry, if you could please turn on your camera, thank you. We will start with introductions. If you and your attorney would introduce yourselves, and then once that's complete, you are welcome to make a statement to the board.
This is Breton Barber, attorney for Dr. Jerry Gentry. She's present. Dr. Gentry?
Good morning.
I just want to make a brief opening statement, and then I want to make my client available for the many questions that I'm sure the board has. What I really want to address is the issue with the Centurion. You know, there's a lot of circumstantial information that's been provided regarding the allegation that she had an inappropriate relationship with an inmate. I would just say a few things. The first thing I would say is, you know, I also have a background in criminal defense. I mean, it seems to me that the most important thing that would be of value would be the photographs. And I to this day, I am mystified as to why if this whole thing was confirmed by the existence of photographs, how is it possible that they don't, this is a very comprehensive investigation, and I commend the staff, but it seems to me those would be available. The other issue I have is if there were indeed photographs, I mean, that's a class 2 felony in the state of Arizona. That's promoting prison contraband. And I fail to see why the county attorney would not pursue charges. Furthermore, if you look at those JPay emails and you look at the interviews with the, I believe, 2 inmates, the stories are changing. They're evolving, especially when you compare them with the emails. They're self-serving. It's also important to remind you that these sessions occur in a monitored environment. It's not like the prisoner and I'm sorry, the inmate and Dr. Gentry just go into a room by themselves and talk. It is monitored 2 ways. First of all, there are always video cameras available. And second of all, there is a Centurion security officer that regularly comes and checks because the room she's in has a window in it that can be seen through. And as far as her termination, I have not been provided with anything. I mean, quite frankly, what this looks like to me is a retroactive termination. I mean, if I'm being completely honest, is something happened on the 31st. She was escorted off the premises. They did whatever investigation. And then when they determined that on that day of the 31st, her security clearance has been revoked, they said, well, that was the date of her termination because she never sat down with anyone. She never talked with anyone regarding termination. And again, I think it's important to note, the only reason that this initially came to the attention of Centurion is because Dr. Gentry went to the deputy warden immediately after this threat occurred from the inmate and told them exactly what happened. And finally, I'll say that I think it was stated at some point that she was revoked because of fraternization or something like that. But I would note that in the ADOC investigation on page 10, they say after investigating the allegation, evidence was found to support inappropriate behavior by Dr. Gentry. So that's, I guess, the investigative finding is inappropriate behavior, not inmate fraternization. And I would leave it at that, and I would make my client available for questions.
Madam Chair, may I ask the counsel just to clarify a question for me?
Dr. Davey?
Yes, sir. Thank you for being here today, and thank you, Dr. Gentry. There's a statement from one of the interviewers, I believe, on August 31st. The interviewer states that they actually showed one of the photos to Dr. Gentry and that she identified herself in that photo. So are you stating today that that is a blatant lie by that interviewer?
No, not at all. I'm just saying, where are the photographs?
Oh, you had also made the statement that the photos had never been shown or never been seen or ever been
to any of us. Correct.
Well, but to Dr. Gentry, she did see that photo from the person that was interviewing her.
Well, I would suggest you ask her that.
I will ask her that. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Dr. Gentry? Dr. Davey?
I'll just start off with that one, I guess. So, Ms. Gentry, Dr. Gentry, sorry. On that date, August 31st, it seems like it was around, I'm looking at the document, about 10 a.m. when you were being interviewed. The individual was talking about the photos. You said you're not sure how they got them. There's about 10 of them. But in there, they indicate that you were shown one of the photos and that you identified yourself in that photo. Is that correct?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that answer.
Yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'll defer back to you for right now.
Do we have additional, Dr. Catarino? You are on mute.
I don't know if Dr. Gentry or Mr. Barber would know this, but I did read that there were cameras. Did anyone look at those videotapes from the cameras?
I don't know. I would certainly hope so, but I don't know.
Is that something that maybe we could subpoena? Ms. Michelson, I don't know.
Dr. Catarino, I have to look back at the report, but I thought there was a reference made to reviewing footage, but that they didn't see any contact between Dr. Gentry and the inmate in question.
Okay. That was maybe just in the room where they were counseling, but maybe in other, on the way there or in the hallway. I don't know.
I can make, this is SW, would it be appropriate if I can make a general statement about kind of the logistics or surroundings in prison, kind of what that looks like? Again, I'm not Department of Corrections, but I do know, I mean, it would be great to get video footage, but I do know their footage like expires, if you will, after a certain amount of time. So that would be unfortunate. But as far as counseling sessions, of course, depending on the inmate and their custody score will depend on, you know, if they're cuffed up or if an officer is right there. But generally speaking, an officer is not in the room with the therapist and the inmate for confidentiality. They are supposed to be in close, you know, sight and close vision, you know, in case, you know, something happens. But that is not a common practice at all that they're in the room with the inmate and the therapist or the doctor. And there's lots of different rooms, you know, it's a prison. There's lots of different rooms that are available to our therapists and or psychologists to go to. You know, depending on the room, it might have a window. Lots of them don't. So I just wanted to kind of give that overall statement that it's not just one room. It's not, you know, constantly monitored. There's often not a security officer in there. So there's definitely lots of room, you know, for different places or different things. So.
And Dr. Catarino, just to clarify your question, on page 90 of the file, the DOC report mentions there was a section about video surveillance, and it says due to these incidents being reported in an area with no surveillance camera and occurring weeks earlier, no video is available.
Okay. And then Dr. Gentry, they said that the prisoner could be in a cage or just so how when you had these sessions, how was the inmate? Was he in a cage? Was he at a cuff to a table?
Okay, so there was typically one of two rooms that was used in the max custody area where I was working. So if we went up to their cell and we would let them know we were there for an individual session, if they wanted to go ahead and get pulled out, they could, or they could talk to us right there, or they could decline to have any type of services provided. If they wanted to be pulled out, we would have to call over one of the COs to then get on the radio, cuff up the inmate, and then let them open the door, bring them into one of those two rooms. So there was the triage room, which was downstairs, where they would be cuffed and shackled with leg restraints around a desk and a big window in that room, as well as cameras. Or upstairs, they would be placed into a cage and then uncuffed, and there was lots of cameras in there as well.
So there was no room where you went where there were no where there was no camera?
Correct.
Okay.
We have additional questions.
I just had a quick question. So when you say there's a camera, is it being recorded too, or is it just a viewing camera?
From my knowledge and my understanding, I believe it is just video, but I don't know how DOC works.
Okay. Dr. Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here, Dr. Gentry. Some of the most recent records we received stated that you were terminated from Sharper Future. Is that correct?
Yes.
Why was that not reported on your application for licensure?
Honestly, I was embarrassed and didn't want to have to explain anything. And then following the NDA, I was unsure as to what I was allowed to disclose. I was under the impression it was just the date of my employment.
Okay. And did you have a relationship with a client outside of work as alleged in that Sherpa Future report?
No, there was one incident where I had stopped at a restaurant near my work just to let traffic die down and was getting a drink with water and iced tea, and I ordered some chips and salsa, and the parolee had come in and sat down, and being new to providing services and kind of that whole situation, I let him sit down, and that's when my friend met with me, and we sat there for about an hour and talked, and we all left separately.
The friend reported that you left in the same vehicle as the client?
I don't know.
You're saying you did not leave? No. Okay. Those are all my questions. Thank you.
Ms. Shreve?
Dr. Gentry, in regards to the photos, were you shown the photos?
I was only shown one, and it was ripped in half and photocopied. It wasn't the original or anything like that. I was never shown any other photos.
So you were just shown one. It was a photocopy, and did you recognize it?
Yes.
And did you ever give these photos to the inmates?
No.
And did you have any inappropriate relationships with any of the inmates?
No.
Is it, can you explain why an inmate may suggest that?
I would be surmising as to why he would suggest that, but based off of the fact that he was searched, his cell was searched, and he was questioned after I had reported him. I think he was just, it was a CYA type of thing, but that would be just a guess.
Okay. And did you ever receive an official termination notice, letter, email, text message?
No, the first time I saw that report was before our last meeting.
All right, thank you.
So, Dr. Gentry, how did the photograph even, get circulated among?
The only explanation that I had was from the pictures that I had printed previously. It was about 2 months prior that I had thought I'd misplaced. Never was I under the impression or did I believe that they would have been on the prison grounds at any point in time. Hence, I didn't report them right away. And it wasn't until the inmate made threats against me that I realized that could have potentially been how he obtained them.
And when you say misplaced,
I had printed a few and was just unsure as to
where did you print them?
At Walgreens.
Uh-huh.
So and I was unsure, they were just gone. So I thought maybe I accidentally threw them away or I dropped them, but never did I believe them to be on prison grounds.
Ms. Shreve?
I'm not familiar with the prison systems. Maybe you can explain. So when you, as an employee, go to the prison system, is there a place where you, do you lock your purse up? Do you take bags with you? I'm trying to understand maybe how these, how do the photos get out? I mean, when you're walking in the prison, are you just taking your notebook and paper that you need? I mean, can you explain how that works?
Yeah, so we were provided a rather large kind of tote bag that was see-through, clear. All bags had to be clear and were inspected upon entry. They were actually inspected twice. You go through the VIP area or the initial, security clearance. You walk through the metal detectors, they search your stuff. And then when you go through the next gate, you do the same thing again. These bags were rather large and I kind of transferred, just a smaller another clear bag with a mirror and some gum, just like my purse contents into this bag. But otherwise, the big, large bag would stay in my car, which when I'd stop at Walgreens, gathering different, supplies and whatnot, as well as possibly the photos, put them into that bag and forgotten about them.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Are there any additional questions for Dr. Gentry? Dr. Davey?
Just a few questions. One, when the Department of Corrections revoked your access, were you informed of that by someone?
I was, by the warden himself. We met and he had told me due to security reasons, he could no longer have me working at that prison, but that Centurion might have another position at another location for me, which I had been spoken to my immediate supervisor about, as well as messaging her, inquiring as to kind of what to do next moving forward.
Okay. And so in the employment file, I believe we have a document from Centurion, one that you signed off on, that clearly states that if you lose your access to the facility, that you will be terminated. Are you familiar with that document?
I'm not familiar with it. I'm sure that I signed in the beginning paperwork as to everything that was said in it. I can't recall everything.
I'm going to, if you just give me 1 second, I would like to be able to just orientate our staff to that document. We've got, you know, as I'm sure you can imagine, several hundreds of pages of files. So in the, on page, PDF 14 of 64, on the employment file, bottom of the page, loss of access privileges and requests for your removal from the program by the client will result in termination from your employment with Centurion. So it's essentially is your at-will statement when you onboarded with them.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what I didn't hear the rest of the question.
You locked up.
Oh, sorry. Did you hear me reading what the statement said? So that I was just saying that that's signed by you on, it looks like under that statement, 12/11/2020.
Okay.
Yeah, so, if I may, I would just note the report also states that Dr. Gentry had a conversation with the warden and he said he didn't know if there was another place for her at Centurion. So.
Yeah, I would say, yeah. And to that, I think that it's pretty clear in the Centurion managed care document that loss of access is going to lead to termination.
I would think the deputy warden would have said that.
The warden isn't connected to Centurion. Those are separate, right? So this is a contract with Centurion. Their contract says termination. Loss of access. Thank you for pointing that out, Dr.
I believe the deputy warden is an employee of Centurion.
No,
that's not correct. Also, Department of Corrections.
Yes, too. I am going to ask that everybody remain muted until called upon or asked a question, please. Dr. Meyer, you were speaking. Did you have an additional question?
No, I was just clarifying what was stated.
Thank you.
And then I have one other follow-up question. No, that's fine. With regard to the issue with Sharper Future, Dr. Gentry, when the information was relayed that you had run into the clients out in public, and I believe that ultimately you said, yes, we did have a drink, did Sharper Future perform an investigation? Did they open an investigation to talk to you and file that information?
I'm unsure as to whether it was an investigation. I had a phone call and a conversation, and it was the only thing that was acknowledged by me was that he had sat down with me and that he had ordered an alcoholic drink.
Okay. So to your knowledge, no investigation by HR around this?
Other than maybe conversations, yeah, that's to my knowledge, that's, you know.
And would it be fair to think that the colleague you worked with, having gone to the supervisor, that her report would trigger an investigation into this matter?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
the list of information that was shared by your colleague at the time, you know, whether it's inaccurate or accurate, she shared quite a list of information that she was concerned about with regard to your activities. And at that time, you know, would it be fair to assume that that would have, I think it was Dr. Craig, that there, he would have investigated the issues brought forward by your colleague?
That's fair.
And the reason I ask is I think it's going to come back to some of the answers that you gave on your application, where we ask you point blank, like, has there been an investigation? Have you been terminated? Have you, like, those are questions that one would expect for these things to come up and for you to be able to explain them to us so that we can adjudicate those incidences. But I'll pause there. I don't have any further questions at this particular point.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. I wanted to seek clarification, Dr. Gentry. So on the application for Centron, it did ask for the past 10 years of employment and had you been terminated from any employment. Can you, again, clarify, state why you omitted the Sharper Future information on that application and why you selected no for having been terminated in the past?
So I believe, I thought I had, and if you scroll through that whole, as far as providing the information, but again, that was after the NDA, and I, from my understanding, of I was only to provide like the, my dates of employment. I was not to speak of anything else regarding my employment until that was clarified by my lawyer after our last meeting.
Thank you. Dr. Gentry, my other question for you is what you're currently providing services. Are those forensic services to patients?
No.
Okay. And what population do you currently provide services to?
Adults and adolescents, and I have a few children, and just general mental health.
Okay. That is the only other question that I had. Thank you. Do we have any further questions from the board members? Hearing none, we will now move into discussion and deliberations. This will be a time where only the board members speak. And so unless there's another question that happens to come up that we grant permission to address, this will just be a deliberation amongst the board. In the lead on this case, so I will begin the deliberations. I'm concerned. I think that there's been quite an interesting approach to omitting information. We have an application before us that still states that there is no termination by an employer. I understand that there could be some wiggle room around whether or not Centrion followed all the HR processes for termination. But the reality of it is we have reason to believe that inappropriate behaviors were, or inappropriate pictures were obtained by a prisoner, and that that there has been more than one place of employment that has presented very similar concerns. I'm also concerned about in the investigation, the fact that the Sharper Future information came about when interviewing prisoners, inmates, which I know that there's ways for information to be obtained, but I think one of the concerns that has been cited or noted is that there seems to be some boundary concerns with what conversations may or may not be had with the clients being served. I think as far as whether or not there are violations, I do think that there are several violations. And I think even if we weeded out some of the blowing of smoke of who did what and where, I think that we could still consider the facts before us. And I still share some of those concerns, even without those components. I'm concerned that we now have two applications before us that seem to misrepresent facts without any attempts to seek clarification or assistance in how to fill out those applications, should there have been any concern or questions. So I'll turn it over to my colleagues on the board as far as thoughts, but I really am thinking that this needs to move forward to the informal review process.
This is Dr. Malott, Dr. Wilson.
Dr. Malott?
Yeah, so I'm very concerned. When we make decisions on our license applications, we are, you know, clients sign something that everything included in there is true and to the best of their knowledge. And decisions are made based on, you know, taking it, taking the information provided as fact and, you know, with different verifications. And our decision would have been very different if we had the rest of the information. And at the least, we would have put the licensee on probation with a supervisor with frequent reports to the board. We would not have issued a full license. I do think this needs to be moved forward. So.
Dr. Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree. We've got two instances of allegations of crossing boundaries with clients, and followed by two terminations, and none of that was reported. So I would make a motion to move it toward for informal review.
And I'll second that. I did want to, though, also, I'm concerned about the status of being able to practice. I know that we currently are not taking, I know that we've got the pending application, but then that it's pending through the duration of this investigation. And if we're moving to informal, that can prolong some of this investigation. So I would also like to consider some legal advice. So can I make a motion to go into executive session for the purpose of legal advice?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries. We should get a link to join the other room.
We're all back.
Thank you. I'm waiting patiently for the videos. Dr. Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. After receiving advice from our attorney, I'd like to withdraw my motion and have further discussion.
And I will withdraw my second as well. Dr. Meyer.
Thank you. So I've got a number of concerns. I think that with consistent lack of providing accurate information about termination, about multiple allegations about inappropriate relationships with clients, I'm concerned about her practicing right now. I don't know if it's a summary suspension or something interim as we proceed, but I think that a practice monitor moving forward right now, I think that something needs to be done immediately about her current ability to practice.
This is Dr. Malott.
Go ahead, Dr. Mott.
Yeah, so one of the thoughts I had was kind of based on what you just said, Dr. Maya, was possibly, asking, I'm hoping we will move to an informal hearing, which will happen in a month, but really asking Dr. Gentry to, she'll continue to work, but under supervision, weekly supervision, maybe recording of her sessions that her supervisor and she will review, including all, case files and notes. During this time, while we continue to do further investigation and the informal hearing. I don't know how we, is that just a request we make, Ms. Galvin, or right now, or?
At this point in the proceeding, because of the nature of the board's concern, what you appear to be asking is if she would voluntarily enter into a consent agreement for supervision, weekly supervision, where the supervisor would review case files and notes and record her sessions. So we could not order that today, but we could ask if she would be willing to enter into this interim consent agreement until we can get to an informal hearing, if that's what I'm understanding.
So Dr. Gentry, you just heard what Ms. Galvin said. I think that would that be something you would agree to?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. We appreciate that. I think, as you know, the board's charge is, to protect the communities we serve and the public, and this would help us reassure that that there is supervision as we continue to do further investigation at the informal hearing.
And we appreciate you allowing her to continue to work with supervision as opposed to moving right to the summary suspension. So I'd like to thank the board.
I think that's a great idea, Dr. Mollett. And I think that alleviates my concern at this point and we don't need to proceed straight to evaluating a suspension, but would like to move forward to the informal hearing as soon as possible.
I would expect,
is that a motion, Dr. Mayor?
Yes, sorry. Motion to offer a consent agreement, as Dr. Mollett suggested, and move to a informal hearing within 30 days, or with 30-day notice.
Dr. Meyer, if I may, let's assume that she agrees to enter into this consent agreement. We get it signed. She will be under supervision. So it may be that we could do this at the June meeting and not necessarily hold a special meeting because she will be under supervision. If she doesn't sign the consent agreement for some reason, then we can hold a special meeting in between our May and June meetings. Is that agreeable?
Yes, that's please amend my motion to that.
And then have potential violations to be cited.
Ms. Michelson, if you could go over the violations that we found in the CSC, I believe there are a couple that we might deem not necessary at this point, but if you wouldn't mind summarizing that would be appreciated.
Yes, Madam Chair, I will go over the 5 violations that the CSC recommended to the board and then also note a couple other ones that I mentioned in my investigative report based on the new information that we received after the CSC's meeting. The 5 violations that the CSC recommended, the first one was 16F, which is sexual intimacies or intercourse with their current client or patient within 2 years after the cessation or termination of treatment. I'm not sure if you want me to go over all of them or just start one by one.
Can we discuss each one? Because I don't think that applies.
I agree. I think we should discuss each one. Thank you, Ms. Shreve.
Yeah, I'm in agreement.
Yeah, not that one.
Okay.
Next one.
The second violation is 16G, engaging or offering to engage as a psychologist in activities not congruent with their professional education, training, and experience.
We don't have enough evidence of that.
Okay, the third violation is 16O, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards of practice.
think with the disclosure of information,
photos.
What's that?
I think the photos
and the application, in, you know, lack of disclosure. That's unprofessional for psychologists.
So I'd say yes to that one.
Okay, there's no further discussion. The next violation was 16Y, exploiting a client or patient or supervisee.
I don't see that at this time.
No, I don't see that.
The next one.
Okay, and the last one recommended by the CSC, and then I'll comment on some of the other ones I mentioned, was 16DD, an ethical code violation pertaining to two sections of the APA code, 3.05, multiple relationships, and 6.01, sexual intimacies.
No.
I don't think we have that in sense.
I think the first one we do. We have another practitioner alleging interaction at the bar and leaving in the car with them. And that's not from an inmate, that's from another provider.
Yes.
So section 3.05, multiple relationships, is that the one you're mentioning?
Okay. Dr. Meyer, sorry, Ms. Michelson, Dr. Meyer, if I may, or Ms. Galvin, I guess for me, in reviewing everything, you know, I think it's interesting that there's nothing in the state of California, like it, the termination happened, but then there were no forward complaints. Are we able, I mean, I don't even know that we would have access to further investigate that particular issue beyond the hearsay of the interview that was provided, unless I missed something.
And these are just potential violations. They're not findings at this time. They're just potential violations.
Right. Perfect. Then yes, I'd be in agreement with.
And there were a couple other violations that I wanted the board to review and consider if applicable today. One of them was 16M, which is using fraud, misrepresentation, or deception to obtain or attempt to obtain a psychology license. And this is with respect to the misrepresentation on the licensure application regarding the no answer to the background question about the termination.
Yes.
Okay, the next one for the board to consider is violation 16J, which is making a fraudulent or untrue statement to the board or its investigators, staff, or consultants. And this is with respect to the misrepresentation about the termination from Sharper Future.
Yeah, I think yes.
Okay, and then the only other one that I noted for consideration is violation 16C, which is making or using statements of a character tending to deceive or mislead with respect to the board answers and also the misrepresentations on her employment application with Centuron.
I say yes again.
Okay, those are the only other ones that I noted. So based on the board's discussion, forwarding to an informal interview based on violations of 16O, 16DD, as it relates to section 3.05, multiple relationships, 16M, 16J, and 16C.
And to offer the interim consent agreement for supervision.
And I do have a question of clarification for the board members. In terms of the supervisor, I do know that the owner of the agency where she works at is a licensed psychologist. Is this someone who the board would be willing to consider to serve as a supervisor or someone outside of the agency?
I'm fine with within the agency.
I think they would know more.
I think have access and may not cost additional money for Dr. Gentry. I'm fine with that.
Thank you.
And then there, I think there were some additional records we wanted to request, prior employment applications.
Yeah, and that can be a direction to staff. It necessarily doesn't have to be part of the motion.
Okay. I have a question about the timing. So you mentioned that it wasn't pursued in California. I don't know if Dr. Gentry was a postdoc. I don't know if she was licensed at the time those
She's never been licensed in California, only Arizona. So there was no
concern why they didn't pursue it.
Yes.
Madam Chair, committee member, or board members, this is Kathy. California does require postdocs to be licensed. It's an associate license, but there is a license.
Oh. Thank you for that clarification.
So we do have a motion, right? Dr. Meyer, do we have a second?
I don't have a second noted.
All right, I'll second it. Any further discussion? Hearing none, do we need a roll call?
Yes, please.
Before we set the roll call, is that what we'd like to have is part of the discussion of giving some board direction around, is the discussion only the motion, or will that close the matter, or will we have a moment to discuss some additional records we're interested in after the vote?
Dr. Davey, we can discuss after the vote.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Ms. Packman, will you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Dr. Catarino?
Yes.
Mr. Diner?
Yes.
Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Dr. Malott?
Yes.
Ms. Shreve?
Yes.
And Mr. Nguyen?
Yes.
Thank you. The vote is 8 yes and no other, no no's, recusals, et cetera.
Thank you. Dr. Davey, would you like to provide some guidance to board staff?
Yeah, there's a couple other records I'd be interested in looking at as we have to gain a better understanding of how applications have been filled out in the past. So I'd be interested in the employment records from Arizona Center for Change while she was working here in Arizona from there. And then I would be interested in her application for employment from Desert Sage as well.
I can certainly obtain that. And also just to note, I did verify in the California Board of Psychology's website that she was a registered psychological assistant from 2018 to 2019. So I can follow up with them to see if any complaints were received during that time frame.
Thank you. Dr. Davey, I am at my point of no longer having hardwired internet.
You sure? And there you go. Good timing.
Meeting over to you if you would not mind.
Now or never. Make the jump while you can. So I think, Ms. Michelson, would you like to go ahead and give a code right now?
Sure, I can go ahead and give a code word for those attending for continuing education credit. That code word is Easter. Again, the code word is Easter.
And with that, Dr. Malott, we're going to lose you here.
I have to make some remarks at 12:10. It's down the hall, but I probably need to go in about 5 minutes. So if there's anything we can do in the next 5 minutes.
May we be excused? I'm sorry.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Both.
Thank you to the board. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Is there anything pressing that we need Dr. Malott for? Can we just roll right into number 11?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the rest of the agenda items. Really, the only one that I think will be quick would be number 16, which is the ASPPB call for nominations.
All right, then let's get Dr. Malott involved in that. So number 16, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding the call or ASPPB call for award nominations. Ms. Packenham, would you provide a summary of the matter of the board and let us know what you need from us?
Yes, Mr. Chair, very briefly, ASPPB issues this call every year for nominations for their award categories.
We are not obligated to forward any nominations to ASPPB. It's certainly our prerogative to do so. There are four, and they are described in your packet. I will acknowledge that it's probably a difficult time to seek nominations for outstanding regulators, given the challenges that we have all had in participating and engaging in activities with ASPPB, but I put it before you in the event you would like to forward any nominations.
Thank you, Ms. Backenon. Do anybody from the board have any thoughts around this matter as of today, or is it one of those things where perhaps it's not this year that we're looking at putting forward?
My experience is, generally speaking, nominations are successful with individuals that have had many years of experience, and so probably this year may not be the best year. It's a lot of work and then for no gain. So
did you get one of those last
year? Yes, I sure did. In fact, I'll get the award formally next week or in 2 weeks at ASPPB this
week.
Can
we do repeats? Or can we pitch it up again?
No, I'm going to be recognized, and they're paying my way to go to ASPPB. Hey, that's plenty of recognition. So,
well, I demand photos so that we can all see you with your in your glorious moment there with that much-deserved award, for sure.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
All right. There's really no action there, Ms. Packenon. Can we move on?
Correct, Mr. Chair. I would suggest we go back up to item 11.
Let's go and scroll back up there. So, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding life coaching paper prepared by the Arizona Psychological Association. We have a guest speaker here, I believe. They would like to present. Is that correct? Is Ms. Flint here?
I'm here. Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair. Yes. Just by way of just a little bit of context before we give Dr. Flint the floor, if you don't mind, because I know this issue sort of predates some of our most recent appointees to this board. Many board members will recall that there were two, three cases that where there was an element of life coaching involved, whether it was individuals who were not yet licensed as psychologists who indicated to this board while under investigation that they were providing life coaching and not psychological services. In one instance, a psychologist had a client who moved out of state, and the services that she claimed to be providing across jurisdiction boundaries were life coaching, whereas he had been a former client. So those kinds of cases were a challenge to this board. And so we tried to look at this from a regulatory perspective, just to sort of see what other information, resources, guidance there might be specific to regulatory boards when dealing with life coaching. And we found virtually nothing in the process. Other jurisdictions reported that they are also presented with these types of challenges, but they have no answers to supply to us at this time. So the Arizona Psychological Association, having an interest in this issue, decided to form a committee or a task force. Dr. Flint will elaborate on that, to take a close look at that issue. And so they formulated a paper, and Dr. Flint asked if she could share it on behalf of ASPA with the board. And so that's why it's on your agenda.
Thank you for that context. All right, Dr. Flint, I keep looking for you on my screen. You keep bouncing around. There you go. I'm going to pin you right there underneath Ms. Shreve's. Ms. Shreve's
that's got never you. A good thing to hear from the board.
Well, Ms. Shreve's got your pin now, so now I know exactly.
Thank you. I appreciate you all taking the time, and obviously we're in a little bit different positions. ASPA is a membership community, and so we can't really say you can't do something or you should do something. But we made this document after doing a great deal of research. We did ethics consults with two ethicists from the trust, also from American Professional, which were two of the bigger organizations that psychologists tend to have malpractice insurance through. Literature searches, lots of reaching out. And we came to the conclusion that a living document made more sense because, of course, we can't say you can't. But the overriding question was, can you have a psychological practice and a life coaching practice concurrently without misrepresenting yourself potentially to the public or having them misunderstand what role you're playing? Are you covered by your malpractice insurance or not? And we as a committee came to the conclusion that you should probably not engage in this practice. It is just too risky. We can't, of course, say you can never. So in that vein, we went forward and just answered a couple of other questions and clarified the importance of keeping your documentation completely separate, even the names of your businesses per se completely separate, not using EHR systems because that implies patient client, not outside client. Doing education and training specific to coaching and some of the limitations. The bigger problem is that there's no real accreditation body. There's a life coaching or coaching federation. It is very broad and there's really no teeth in that organization at all. So when something goes wrong, it's going to keep coming back to the state boards likely. And we did the same investigation that Heidi did, and states just keep kind of saying, we don't know what to do, and so we'll look for somebody else to take the lead. There was not a whole lot of concrete evidence. Life coaching is very difficult to distinguish from your clinical practice. And Dr. Harris at the Trust said over and over again, if it quacks like a duck and it walks like a duck and it looks like a duck, it's a duck. And so that's kind of how we present it to our constituency as well. It was met with some conversation. We do have a lot of psychologists who feel like this is a great source of income and that they can navigate this slippery slope quite well. So we provided these guidelines, and interestingly, we learned another little tidbit that might be of great interest to the board. The Department of Defense has started to use the term coaching as a specific subset of psychological interventions that are practiced by psychologists and licensed mental health providers and are subject to their regulation. So now we also have a semantics issue of within DOD, you can coach, AKA do psychology things. But in general practice, we're saying that's probably not a great idea to overlap those two different areas. So that's the Cliff Note version. And we have this committee continually open. We are taking comments and criticisms from membership, of course, and would welcome any comments that you all have as well. But this was our first stab, version 11. So you can see that it went through quite a few iterations, but we think we landed on a fair document of warning before people engage in this practice.
Right. Thank you so much, Dr. Flint. So do we want to have some questions from the board or any comments around this at this time?
No, I would just say thank you. I think if there was an issue that came up, then we're all like, what? I mean, what your evaluation, your recommendation and findings are pretty much, I think, what a lot of us felt like, but it was hard to determine, you know, so I think your background search and all that was very, really well done. And I think made perfect sense on why those two shouldn't necessarily, you know, cross paths, and your recommendations, if they were to, how to handle it. So no, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Shree.
Dr. Meyer.
And I'd echo that. Thank you. And thanks to you and to the committee for all of your work on this. I think it's very important. And I think this is a great statement to get out there.
Absolutely. And I think, again, just echoing the great work, because I do believe this is something that we have bumped into and most likely will bump into in the future. My question, I guess, is kind of pragmatic of how will you relay this information to your membership? How will you relay this information to those that are instructing future psychologists, supervising soon-to-be psychologists? How will we get this information into your constituents' hands and then ultimately our licensees' hands?
So we have posted this on our website. Of course, that is in the members section as it's a membership organization. However, it also got posted on our full listserv, which includes people who are at all different membership levels. And there is no opposition for us to share this document outside of the organization as well. And we have been forwarding it to our internal supervisors at Midwestern, just kind of trying to get the web out a little bit. So if you have suggestions on where you'd like to see it go, I can check with governing council, but I am quite sure that they are fine with it moving forward in whatever way to get it out into the hands of people.
And I for one would be interested in this, at least just, you know this better than I, the training institutions that we have here in Arizona, how do we get that in the department's chairs, so hands, so that they can share that with their students or share that with those they interact with? With regard to those already practicing, I would believe you all as the Arizona Psychological Association have access to these individuals that would most benefit from your documentation of this matter.
I can absolutely look into sending it to the major educational partners for them to be able to share with their students and alumni.
And then Ms. Packanen, probably not something we would ever put on our website, correct? We really wouldn't say direction around life coaching or anything along that, correct?
Correct, Mr. Chair. I was just going to request to weigh in on this. We will receive inquiries undoubtedly about this topic. And so our practice is, as board staff, to never attempt to interpret the statutes and rules or the application thereof. So as a matter of routine, what we do is we respond with some sort of statement that sounds something like this. We can't comment as board staff. We would be providing a legal opinion if we did, and we're not qualified to do so. However, if you are a member of your state association, then you may consider reaching out to that organization for any resources or information that they have. So in doing so, we're sort of drawing attention to the value of belonging to your professional membership association and accessing material and resources.
Thank you so very much. Any other comments before we move on? Hearing none, thank you so much. And please thank all those that worked so hard on this. Dr. Flint, we appreciate it. Moving on to number 14, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding report on ASPPB board member training. I guess here we've got, do we have another guest speaker coming to us on this time?
Mr. Chair, just that meeting was attended by Mr. Wynn, and he graciously agreed to report out. Dr. Catarino attended as well, so she may have other thoughts that she wants to share, but we tasked Mr. Wynn with being the lead on this agenda item.
I saw the Mr. Wynn, I was like a guest speaker. I'm like, well, actually you are a full-fledged board member. So I apologize for thinking you're just here to, moonlight. So please, Mr. Wynn, take it away.
I do moonlighting as well. So too unexpected. I'll be short and I'll be quick because I know we've spent a good amount of time this morning, but I did find the webinar, which was specifically focused on new board members, to be impactful. I think it was definitely a 101, and it ended up being an incredibly good primer on kind of the role of psychologist boards across the United States, what these boards are for, the purpose, and a lot of the history. ASPB started from the beginning, history of regulations, origins of the Hippocratic Oath, the history of licensure of physicians in the United States, and went through kind of the states versus federal rights in licensure and the history of psychologist licensure, specifically in the United States. And random fact there, Connecticut was the first to license psychologists in the United States, and Missouri was the last. Spent a lot of time kind of on the reasoning, the background of licensure of psychologists and the arguments for and against, which I thought was incredibly interesting and kind of helped reinforce the need for these boards and the purpose of them in protecting the public health. Talked a lot about the unique responsibilities of board members. And of course, in a plug for ASPB, PPB itself, they talked a lot about the history of the association. Not to get too much into the specifics and in the weeds, but they did talk a lot about the role of the board, what the board does, board members do, and what the board does not. Gave some of the pitfalls of kind of stepping outside the bounds and responsibilities of a board. and gave some really great background. You know, I'm coming as a member of the public, even though I've served on many boards in different kind of issue areas. Certainly this is new to me. So I thought it was fascinating about kind of the history of how boards like this, everything from physicians all the way up to psychologists, on kind of the Hippocratic Oath, all the way to what led to the history of licensing psychologists in the States. And went into, which I also found fascinating because of my day job being in state level government relations, about recent Supreme Court cases on licensed professionals and how the courts have generally ruled in favor of states' rights to develop and implement professional licensure requirements. So overall, I think I found it to be fascinating. It was a great 101 on the purpose, objective, role of board members, and why we all do what we do on a Friday afternoon. I think that's probably the best rundown I can give without getting into too many specifics, but happy to ask, answer any questions. And honestly, what I got out of as well is the ASPPB. Seems like a very worthwhile organization, particularly as a new board member, for gaining more information on how I can be a better board member in the future.
Very cool. And so you highly recommend this for everyone?
Honestly, I think everybody comes from different backgrounds, but I think anybody who had joined the webinar would have gained some knowledge and some insight that would help you be a better board member. So yeah, I would recommend attending these in the future.
So maybe Ms. Packin, I would just keep an eye out for the next one, and we can always just alert board members that these opportunities are available. I think some of us enjoy just learning a little history and as to why we do the things we do. And I, for one, you know, probably fall in that boat. So yeah, if we see those opportunities arise, you know, based on Mr. Wen's glowing recommendation here as two thumbs up as five stars, then this may be something we want to share with additional board members.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I'll make sure that any opportunities for learning will be forwarded for your consideration.
Thank you so much. Any other comments from board members before we move on?
You did a wonderful job, but I just said, I'm always like a little picky person. So I noticed that one of the things they mentioned that we should consider having a separate email from the board, because you might have all your emails examined if there's any charges against you or the board. So that might be interesting if the board gave us separate emails. And then secondly, what was the other one? If you're recused, you have to turn off the computer entirely. Turn off everything entirely. You can't even have it on. And then you should be called, or somebody should notify you when you come back in. Those are just two little things I remember. But you did a wonderful job.
And Mr. Chair, I can comment on Dr. Catarino's, what her takeaways were, which we've had some, I appreciated her bringing them to me shortly after the training, which so we've had some conversation around them. The issue with separate emails, certainly we could assign a dedicated email address with the domain name for this board to board members. The cost is, you know, a factor. Unfortunately, we have to look at it from that perspective, at least in part. So it would be about a $1,200 expense for board members on an annual basis. You know, there are free, of course, email addresses that can be considered to be a substitute for an email address that board members use for other purposes. So I just sort of, you know, raise that as a possible consideration. Of course, if any board member wants to change their email address, just notify Krishna and we'll make sure that that gets implemented. What I heard Dr. Catarino tell me with respect to the recusals advice, it sounded to me to be quite consistent with what Ms. Galvin has advised recusing members to do, which is, you know, turn off the camera, leave the room, and then wait for a signal, probably a text message from board staff to say, okay, agenda item's over, you can come back to the meeting. So I appreciate that ASPPB and this board anyway, that our thoughts are very much aligned in that respect.
I wanted to comment on the email system. I, for one, would think that it would behoove us to kind of take a look at that and maybe add that if we have to add it to a future agenda meeting, whether or not we have the budget for it or the IT support to do it. Just as we continue to use the Google folders and things along those lines, and if the state of Arizona is a Google convert, you know, how can we streamline some of those things that our communications, the documents, everything is there in a singular workplace? So I, for one, would like to get that added to a future agenda, just to kind of leverage our own technology, leverage our own ability to stay organized. And I think to some respect, also the control that the board has over those documents, so that people can be, you know, you can turn people's access on and off at a given moment pretty quickly within there. You can, we have access to ongoing communications in terms of retention of emails, retention of documents. And I would think our legal experts on this call would believe that that's probably a step in the right direction. Any other comment? Oh, yes, Diana.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in terms of recusal, a thought sort of occurred to me. Sometimes if there are recusals on the consent agenda, it's a very quick 1 minute thing. I mean, with the recused board member, we vote on the consent agenda. I mean, in that circumstance, what's the proper process? Do we need any discussion there? I mean, I, for one, it's such a quick thing that it doesn't even occur to anyone.
I don't recall that they discussed anything in detail. Do you, Mr. Wind?
No, I didn't think we got into any great depth there.
Ms. Galvin? Recusal on an item would be, you know, if you're discussing something, it might take like an hour or 2 hours to discuss an item on something. And in that sense, closing everything makes sense. But on the consent agenda, which is very quick, if there's any guidance, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
And we can discuss that at length in an additional meeting if you want, but typically on the consent agenda, if there's a recusal, it's usually on just one, you know, small item. And we would just ask that the person who's recused not make the motion or second the motion, but you are voting on the other items. So there would be no need to, you know, turn off your camera or, you know, leave the room, et cetera.
Thank you for that clarification.
And just to be clear, Ms. Steinhardt, do you want that added for further clarification as an agenda item, or are you feeling as if satisfied with Ms. Galvin's response?
I'm personally satisfied because I have very few recusals, but I do know there are recusals on the consent agenda.
Okay. All right, any other comments from board members? Hearing none, we'll move on to number, I can't lose track here. I don't want to fail Mrs.
15.
15, oh, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposed legislation, including but not limited to a bunch of House bills and Senate
bills. Well done, Mr. Chair. And this will be very brief. Because the legislature has shifted a lot of its focus to, we'll call it, big ticket issues, most notably working on the series of fiscal year 2023 budget bills. So I have only a couple of bills to report any progress on, most of which I've discussed at length about the likelihood that they would be signed by the governor. And in fact, they have. So House Bill 2178 that amends the board's exemption statute for school psychologists. We've discussed that many times, and that bill was signed. So we will see that statute change 90 days after the conclusion of the legislative session, which is an unknown at this point in time, of course. And then, as predicted, House Bill 2612, the bill that strips the good moral character language as a licensure requirement out of the behavior analyst statute, that too has been signed. Same situation, 90 days effective date following the sine die of the legislature. And then the only other bill that I wanted to, Senate Bill 1309, that was the Stryker bill, which you all were informed of by email by me. That was the strike everything bill that emerged to extend the length of the temporary emergency licenses. They now all expire on January 1, 2023. The governor had requested that bill. And so not surprisingly, he signed it quickly. And so we have notified all of the temporary emergency license holders, psychologists and behavior analysts, that rather than a termination date at the conclusion of the state of emergency, now their licenses are in effect until January 1 of 2023. The last bill that I'll just briefly comment on is Senate Bill 1568. That is the one that I have described that does impose some additional requirements relative to investigative matters on regulatory boards. Most of the provision of that bill were already in compliance with. The one piece that is causing the consternation is the limit on the number of days that boards are afforded to complete investigations. So that bill hasn't moved in several weeks. What's happening right now is there is some data being collected relative to the fiscal impact of implementing these requirements. And so what boards are supplying now is information relative to, we would need, you know, more investigators, it would cost us this much, and those kinds of things. So that's only in the fact gathering phase. And so I don't know what that will mean once that fiscal note is prepared. Sometimes, often even a fiscal note will determine whether a bill actually does go forward. So I simply don't know at this time what its chances are, but it is sort of in a holding pattern. And that is the one bill that I'm watching most closely at this point. And I'm happy to answer questions about any of those bills or anything of interest to you that I didn't talk about.
Dr. Meyer.
So I just want to clarify, you do not have to have good moral character to be a behavior analyst?
Or a psychologist.
I just asked about behavior analyst.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm going to, I'll plead the fifth.
Okay. And then my real question was, I think it fits in sort of with this, where are we at with the rewrites of our rules and statutes to comply with the most recent bill passed for us?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Meyer, so that the notice of proposed rulemaking has been filed and published in the Arizona State Register. So I will send everyone an update with respect to really the next step, which is the public hearing for rule comments, which is May 20th. So I will send that out. You're welcome to attend. And then I'll inform you about where we go from that point in time. I'm really guessing, predicting that the effective date of those rules will be September, October-ish.
Okay, so there, it's all written. There's like a final copy for the public to look at now.
Yes, yes, and it's published in the register, and I'll send you a link to that.
Okay, and is there possibility for edits based on public comment then?
Mr. Chair, yes, Dr. Meyer. The public comment would come back to the board, and the board could, I think you're required to actually evaluate the content of those comments and make a decision whether the comments compel you to do anything different to your proposed revisions.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Following along the things you said, Ms. Pakanan, about the public meeting and getting that information to us if we want to listen, do we need to alert you if we plan to listen in the event that five or six of us are going to listen in? We would have to provide notice.
Mr. Chair, great question. And this is something that may not be well understood on the part of the board. So what Dr. Davey is describing is a situation where we may find ourselves accidentally with a quorum situation. So my practice is that when we're conducting this kind of a public open meeting, that I would post a courtesy notice on the board's website to explain this is not a board meeting. There may be a quorum of members present, but there will be no discussion about board matters. So also to explain how the hearing works, we are not to really answer questions or engage with the individuals who come forward to offer public comment anyway. We're there simply to collect the comments. So there wouldn't be any conversations anyway, but I will make sure that that language is really clear on the courtesy notice that we post to the public.
Thank you.
I hope I'm not getting too far off topic, but that public notice, potential quorum, do we do something about, like for the AZPA conference? Okay.
Yes, AZI.
Or like the training next week, the multicultural training that AZPA is offering next week. Is that something that we need to let you know about, or?
No, that's a continuing education is my understanding.
Right.
And so no, but if we knew that if several board members were presenting at one CE at the association meeting, we would post that. If we would post if you were all attending a meeting here of ASPBB, but no, just if you are in your own capacity attending the CE, no, that's not a requirement.
Okay, thank you.
And in the past, I think you've even asked if we were, you know, I think if Diana and I were attending the same conference, right? If there was a group of us that was going to end up even out of state together at a conference, we would most likely post that as well. Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I know staff, there are some events that are known to us. And so that would trigger our, you know, posting of a courtesy notice. But if there are events, I guess a best practice would be if you're attending an event and there's a possibility that another member of this board, you know, may attend, go ahead and notify me. Posting the notice takes 2 minutes. And so, you know, I'd rather do that out of an abundance of caution than fail to do so. And then there's a perception that there are, you know, four board members in the same place at the same time, and they're observed to be talking, and that definitely lends a bad perception to the public. So thank you.
Thank you. All right, well, we've already covered 16, so we'll move on to agenda item 17.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt. I think we inadvertently hopscotched over number 12.
Well, maybe I didn't like number 12. Isn't that the
prerogative of the chair?
Oh, that's the prerogative of the chair, correct? Yeah, so the prerogative of the chair. We'll get to 12. I guess we'll go back to 12. Where are we at? I'm scrolling through my documentation here. No, let's have some good news before we get to 12. Let's talk about in-person meetings. Let's talk about 16. So let's discuss that one if everybody's okay. So discussion, consideration, possible action regarding licensure and regulatory issues relative to COVID-19 and resuming in-person meetings. Let's discuss that. Just back in it.
Very good, Mr. Chair. So obviously the big news was the lifting of the state of emergency late last month, and that precipitated some changes on the part of board staff in terms of, you know, certain waivers or certain accommodations, if you will, certain modifications. Those discontinued immediately with the lifting of the state of emergency. So we wanted the board to understand, however, I've supplied them in the memorandum, which of those waivers extend past this date. And so staff is avidly tracking these and, you know, paying attention to when these also conclude. We're in the process as well of removing content from our website that referred to these waivers. We still have a little bit of work to do, but for the most part, we think that what we're representing now to the public is current and accurate. So there may be some questions, there may be some issues that we haven't anticipated. This is all novel to us, certainly. So it may be that this board in the coming weeks and months, you may see cases or instances where we come to you for some direction, because undoing some of these waivers may be more complicated than we had anticipated. Again, it's all very new. So the purpose of this agenda item first was to inform you about, you know, how we're making these transitions and how we're concluding certain actions, but then also to, again, revisit this issue of when do we resume in-person meetings. I did receive an email, I think just as maybe yesterday, very recently, that, and I've alluded to this to you before, that because of the audio technology, how it was increasingly becoming unreliable, there are some boards that are pooling resources on a collective basis to address those issues and to update the technology. We know that the best of the boardrooms is going to be under construction at least through June 30th. And it could very well be longer because of supply chain issues in acquiring the actual, you know, technology resources to make those updates. We're also still waiting for some indication from the General Services Division of Department of Administration relative to, have we been able to pool enough money from the various boards, that some of which are small and relatively poor, others have more resources, but have we cobbled together enough money to potentially address the technology needs in the other meeting rooms? It could be that it's already a challenge in some ways to coordinate, you know, all the board's needs for that space. But when we take rooms out of commission on a temporary basis, it will exacerbate the challenges. What I'm suggesting, I think where I'm coming to in terms of a suggestion, is that we can make a decision relative to, let's try to meet in person on a, you know, designated month. But we acknowledge we need to have a backup plan in case that room isn't available, in case, you know, it's under construction. And then we clearly have a fallback, which will be the Zoom platform. So that's really my suggestion, but I'll take whatever direction the board would like to give to staff on that topic.
Have board members any thoughts?
Do we need to come back in person?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. The question really is, come back in person with some backup plans, just in case someone's not feeling comfortable coming back in person, or technology fails one way or the other. Is that kind of the idea?
And Mr. Chair, for what it is worth, there are at least some boards who have said, we're virtual forever. We know, of course, that we are complying with open meeting law and all of those other considerations by meeting in this capacity. There are boards who have met in person with few exceptions through much of this time frame. And then, you know, many of us have just sort of said, we'll wait and see, we'll use this platform for a while. So there isn't, there's a whole range of opportunities before us. I just wanted you to sort of be aware of that.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Diner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my thoughts are, it's sort of a all or nothing proposition, because I've seen hybrid meetings can be challenging for everyone. So I serve on one of the board, the dental board, and the dental board has had hybrid meetings where some board members attend in person in the conference room on Adams Street, and some board members attend virtually. And there's just tons of technology problems. I mean, we are still complying with open meeting laws, and you know, of course, you know, everyone is present, quorum, all of that is taken care of. But in terms of, is that easier for the staff? Definitely not. So I guess, I mean, from my perspective, online meetings or virtual meetings have been very successful with the psychology board. And, you know, I guess, I mean, if I were to present a preference, I mean, it works just fine. Why fix it? But I also understand that, you know, if we need to go back to in-person meetings, of course, you know, we'll do that. But if we can pick between virtual and in-person, maybe, you know, virtual has worked better in my opinion. Maybe we can have an in-person meeting once or twice a year, and all of the other meetings would be in person, would be virtual. So those are my sort of thoughts or opinions. Thank you.
Yes, Dr. Meyer, thank you.
We used to have other, like, wasn't it every other month was in person and the other was a phone call?
A phone call.
And so maybe a hybrid like that. I seriously doubt I can go back to wearing ties, though.
Not wearing a tie. No, not wearing a tie. Sorry.
This is as good as it gets at this point.
I barely can put on pants these days. You know, full disclosure, like,
Dr. Davis.
I want to disclose, the other day I did go to a meeting outside of like my little bubble of Gilbert. I went up to Scottsdale. My wife's like, I'm going to take a picture of you, honey. You're all dressed again. I got a dress shirt on. It was like my first day of school. I was like, well, it's like, it was very embarrassing. And so I share it with all of you as my friends.
Dr. Davies.
Yes, go ahead,
Michelle. I think Dr. Meyer is right. I think for a long time, as I recall, we would meet by phone, I think, regularly, except for one meeting a quarter or something like that, we met. So, I mean, that was before Zoom. I mean, I've been on this board for a while, but that we had a morning meeting. They usually didn't last this long, and I'm sure Ms. Galvin could jump in on that too. But it was, you know, so I'm wondering if we could do a like kind of a hybrid of, you know, most of the, you know, once a quarter we maybe meet in person, so it's four times a year, and the rest would be on Zoom. And I think when we met on the quarter is like during long, you know, like long meetings or I don't know, a lot of business stuff, but that might be, especially from the travel where everybody lives at, we're all, you know, if that would work better. But that would be my preference, more of a hybrid. Either we're there or we're on Zoom. I agree with Mr. Diner. I think, and I've done that teaching Zoom where you're in person and not, and it's hard. It's really hard.
Other board members' thoughts? So do you think we want to ask Ms. Packenham to put together like a preliminary, not even calendar, but just like what it might look like to have a couple of in-person meetings, you know, maybe beginning like the last one in the summer or maybe in the fall, whatever she may decide, maybe kind of look at a cadence that we could to look at. And then also understanding like Dr. Meyer and Dr. Malad have like university obligations that hit during particular times. Like I always know Dr. Malad with graduation and different things, like they're super busy and don't like to travel. I think Dr. Meyer has a much cushier job. He just shows up when he wants, but Malad does work for our state dollars. And so maybe you could put together something just knowing kind of the board members' cadences or schedules. Is that possible?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think that the first possible in-person meeting could be August 5th. We do have a room reserved in the building. What's just unclear is whether that one will be slated for construction at any particular time. So I think what we'll develop, and I'll involve the team, the staff team, we will sit down and we will outline some possible scenarios with backup plans, the backup plan being obvious, but we'll take a look at that and we'll propose something that we hope will facilitate successful meetings
going forward.
Yeah. I just want to say that we should have an option that maybe you, because I may have to have a couple surgeries, and like I, you know, that I could meet from home, maybe just when there are health issues or something like that.
Mr. Chair, yes, I and Dr. Katerina, just I haven't gone into this degree of specificity, but I do know that some of the enhancements that they are talking about or planning for the meeting rooms would be to help accomplish that hybrid kind of meeting that Mr. Dinar has experienced, and you know, experienced the good, bad, and the ugly. But hopefully this new technology will enable our members who can't come to an in-person meeting, but we clearly need them for a quorum, so we can connect you virtually and be successful in the process. We only have one meeting room in the building that facilitates that right now, and we didn't purchase any of the technology that facilitates that. So it's kind of one of those situations where, you know, how much can we ask the other boards to let us borrow their stuff? So I know that's something that's part of the strategy.
And many of you on the board don't know that the way we used to do that was there would be a table in the middle of the room around our U-shaped bigger table, and there'd be a regular old phone, and then they put your name tag next to the phone. Literally, it just would have your name and a phone, and then we would, you know, and you would listen in just telephonically. So that was pre-COVID. That's how great our technology was. All right, thank you for that, and thank you for letting us know that you'll need some additional assistance around those in-person ones, depending on the timing and your and the surgeries. All right.
Mr. Chair, if I could interrupt, give the last CE code word. We are at the 4-hour mark, so continuing education credit will be given. The last code word is April Fools, and that's April Fools. Thank you.
I'd just like to point out my masterful ability to make sure that this achieved 4 hours in my particularly running the agenda for the last 90, you know, last 30 minutes. All right, number 12, coming back to Dr. Katerina, saving the best for last. Discussion, possible action regarding report of the school psychologist licensure exemption committee. Dr. Katerina, can you please provide a summary of the matter for the board?
Yeah, I'll try to go quickly because I know that people would like to leave by one, I think. There were 4 meetings in a year because we had a lot of difficulty getting everyone coordinated. We had committee members. I started off with about 3, Dr. DiBacco and Dr. Malott and a couple of school psychologists. And then it expanded to have representatives from each of the universities and from the State Department, and also ASPA, though Dr. Stafford could not attend, and the Arizona Association of School Psychologists. So I just want you to realize that it's getting bigger, which then, of course, has more difficulty in scheduling and in consensus. So the original goal was to develop a substantive policy statement regarding the licensure exemption, which you all know is that a school site was written in ARS 32-2075, that a school psychologist employed in a school could use the title of school psychologist. Now, I'll get to that changed, but the issue was, there's a big issue as should it be they're employed or they're contracted, because nowadays there's a lot of these contract programs where people run services where they're not employed by the district, but a school psychologist could be contracted with an agency and then go in and do the work at a school. So what happened is this came up, and then unbeknownst to the committee, some of the people from the Arizona Association of School Psychologists went to one of this House representatives, Udall, and they changed, and that's the law that you're familiar with, House Bill 2176, where they allowed the term to be used by school psychologists that are employed or contracted with the district. So that's off the table now because that changed the law. But there were several questions that were not quite unanimously agreed upon. And so what I've done is I sent them out on a separate page, and I wanted you guys to maybe give me your opinions on these, and maybe we could discuss them at the next meeting if you would just look over. So quickly, they are the independent educational evaluations. This is listed in IDEA, and it just says that an outside person who's qualified can do an evaluation. This is when a parent disagrees with what the school district's evaluation has found. So it doesn't say that it has to be done by a psychologist, but we are looking, does that mean that that's a school psychologist that's functioning, independently? Or do they have a private practice? But the district people said that they've only used licensed psychologists to do this, but we had a case here where one of the districts used a school psychologist that was not licensed to do independent educational evaluation. So that's one of the questions I have for you. The title of psychologist has to be only used by, can that be used by certified unlicensed school psychologists? Many of the committee members said that while they're in a school, they're just called psychologists, not school psychologists, that they're told they're doing psychological reports, not psychoeducational evaluations. And they may be using the root word psycho, even though they're not licensed psychologists. So that's the question that is, what do we want to say about that versus what's happening in the schools? The big issue that really started all this, and it's been going on for years, we looked at the history, is should non-licensed school psychologists have a private practice? And before it was clearer because people had to go in a school to do the evaluations, but then with Zoom and the contracting, sometimes they were doing evaluations and therapy from a private office and not in a school. And then some of the people that did this said that they were doing consultation or advocacy. And so, we don't know if that's, the question is, would that be private practice for non-licensed school psychologists? And you have a question on that. I explained the law. And then just quickly to summarize on the last page there is we did agree that school psychologists are covered by licensure exemption, that we think that the certified school psychologists can be contracted or employed, but could only conduct evaluations within the school. We never quite agreed on the title violations. Now, this came up, the next point came up in one of our sessions here is, it came up one time that a school psychologist was practicing and did have a private office, but did not have a license, and it was dismissed. And it was said that we do not have the purview because these people are not licensed, but we can issue a cease and desist order, and we can refer them to legal, like assistant district attorney. If people are, we can also refer certified school psychologists to the State Department of Education, and that would be another way that we can deal with this population. So you have these questions and just maybe your thoughts on those for the next session. And that's it. Any questions?
Thank you, Dr. Catarino. I think, we've got, if people are trying to leave at one, we still have a little bit of time here maybe to discuss some of these things, and maybe we don't have to put this on a future agenda.
Okay.
So in reviewing this information, I mean, I think the main point of what brought about kind of pulling together this committee that then it looks like it expanded for a multitude of reasons was the main issue, if I remember correctly, was what the legislation already addressed, right? That can a certified non-licensed school psychologist practice independent of schools? And the legislation is now no, correct? And there is
no, the legislation, the way I understand it, is that the legislation was dealing with, can it be employed by a school district or contracted by a school district? And the law was changed to add that they can, the exemption applies to school psychologists that are contracted by a district.
Okay. And that was, what originally kind of led us down this path of getting some of these questions and delving into this.
No, that was one question. Really, what led us down the path were some of the cases we had where it appeared that people had private offices and were seeing patients privately, but only had a school psychology certificate and not a license.
And in those cases, we were not very happy about those, if I remember correctly, that they were engaging in those practices. All right. Thank you for that. Does anybody else have any other questions?
I guess I don't recall them having the issue of private office, because I mean, can a school psychologist sit down and counsel a student? I mean, are they strictly for
in a school setting?
Right. So we did have contractors that did an evaluation on students outside the school setting, but they were contracted with the school.
No, they still had to be in a school. The question is, there's independent educational evaluations, one of those. They could be done in somebody's, like a licensed psychologist would do those in their private offices. So the question is, you know, could a certified school psychologist do that away from a school?
And the answer was, by law.
Unclear.
Okay.
It doesn't apply to anything, because IDEA said as long as the evaluation is done by a person qualified to do it.
Right. So why do we care whether it's in a school or not? I don't know.
Because the exemption only applies to working in a school.
Does the law say that?
Yes. ARS 3275, a school psychologist said they can.
The school setting.
Has to be in a school setting.
Okay.
Part of the duties of a person's common school, high school, or charter school employment. And it would just change, they just changed to add contract. But it had to be in a school. And then with the Zoom, some people were doing the evals, not actually in a school or in their own office or things like that.
Mr. Chair, so I recall we had some discussion about the difference between in a school versus in a school setting when we were discussing the proposed legislation, which is now, you know, signed by the governor. If I recall correctly, the discussion was because the legislature, even before this amendment, had used the word in a school setting, that expands the actual places where the evaluation occurs. It doesn't have to occur in a school building. It can occur in a private office, it can occur, you know, somewhere else. So at least that is my understanding. And of course, I mean, could it be clearer? Probably, but I mean, is it clear enough? In my mind, it is. But again,
a school psychologist employed or contracted in a common school, high school, or charter school setting, correct, is certified to use that title by Department of Ed if the services or activities are part of the duties of that person's school, high school, charter school employment. So it has to be part of their association with the district or a private or charter school. Not even a private school, actually. A common school, high school, or charter school. So I think if you look at some of these questions I have, maybe, you know, I would appreciate, maybe you would have a good perspective on this.
Well, Dr. Katarina, thank you for leading this. It's moving us in the right direction. Is the goal to offer a substantive policy statement, or
I don't feel that this committee is ever going to reach a consensus. Everybody has their own agendas. So I thought, you know, what does the board think? Because we are really come down to it. We're really the ones that can make some of these decisions. And then if we do have a consensus within the board, maybe we can do a substantive policy statement.
But we don't regulate.
them.
Right, but it would be a way that we can interpret the law.
We regulate the practice of psychology, which the whole issue here has been school psychologists that are not licensed are at times practicing as licensed psychologists. So we don't have anything to say about when they're working in a school setting, but when they're not, that's absolutely our jurisdiction.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, can I weigh in with maybe one suggestion, which is, again, we don't know the effective date of this change, September, probably, maybe the end of August at the earliest. So we'll be dealing then with language that has been modified. The board could make an attempt at that point to arrive at a substantive policy statement interpreting the new language, the new statute language. If that is not successful for whatever reason, then the other option would be you meet with stakeholders and discuss a possible statutory revision to that language, knowing that there are going to be very divergent opinions about those issues and those topics. So that's in my mind what I think the board could consider doing next.
So discuss again once we have the final statutes and incorporate Dr. Caterino and her committee's work and have a discussion then.
And then hopefully your input on these questions.
Yes, and it may be that, you know, this board struggles as much as the committee did to arrive at a substantive policy statement and agreement on that language, but you all are your regulators, and so your thoughts may be more closely aligned, and it could be an easier process for you.
When do you want our responses?
I was hoping either at the next meeting, or if we get them before, we could discuss it at the next meeting. But whatever, you know, I don't know, you probably have so much to do, but if whatever you think is appropriate.
So if you want to take the next however many days, I guess, and review those that have comments, I guess we can add it to the agenda and we can discuss the comments if that's what you're feeling, Dr. Meyer.
Yes, yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Thanks. So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Galvin, if board members want to draft their thoughts, they would send those to me, and then I would collect and assemble them so that members are not sharing this information with one another ahead of the meeting.
That's correct.
Thank you.
So maybe following the meeting, Ms. Packenham, maybe to the board members, circulating just those questions that if people have thoughts that they would respond and send back to you, not the entire group.
Okay. Would I see them before or at the meeting?
Heidi could provide them to you.
Okay.
So I suppose Mr. Chair. So I suppose when board members give Ms. Packanen their thoughts on the interpretation of the new language, all of that would be in the package that all of us receive for the next or next to next board meeting. So everyone has a chance to review everyone else's thoughts at that point and come prepared at the meeting to discuss those, right?
That's correct. I just understood Dr. Caterino to maybe receive the comments once Heidi has collected them, maybe prior to dissemination to the full board, so she can prepare and review.
That's what I was thinking, yes. Send out the questions, I think we could put the new law, the exact wording on there too. Thank you.
So just a point of clarification. So the board members' thoughts aren't going to the school psychologist committee. It's just going to the full board correct?
And to me prior.
Well, to everyone, to all the board members.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, yeah, Mr. Donner's point is that once Heidi has them already, they're going to go to everybody at the same time. Dr. Caterina will have a week's early access, I guess. It would be.
I misunderstood. I thought I would.
Okay. It would just come with the packet. But once the board materials are up, then, you know, whatever materials Heidi has received at that time will be in there.
No, I didn't intend to send it to the committee, but I did think that I would have them before so I could research them, but that's fine.
My understanding is the committee disbanded.
Yeah, right.
But Ms. Pakkanen, you said the language is going to change, like, as it exists right now for the new bill, that's going to change. So should we wait to have this discussion until that final, until we can review that in its finality?
Mr.
Because
Chair.
We're still going to have to wait, right? Mm-hmm. Or it, those changes may address some of our concerns mm-hmm. or resolve some of them.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, since we know, good question, Dr. Meyer, since we know what the change will be, it's just a matter of when it will be. I don't see that there's a problem for the board to do this work in preparation for that whatever date in August, September that the language is in effect. Unless Ms. Galvin sees it otherwise, I don't think there's a problem with this board working on and making progress toward a possible substantive policy statement to interpret what is going to be known language. We just couldn't publish it until after the statute changes.
Correct. Okay.
Yeah, my understanding is just adding that and contracted by. That's it.
Okay.
But until it's signed, there's a chance it could always be, you know, changed. So okay. With that caveat.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. And I think with that, unless I skip something else exciting, we can move down to number 18, new agenda items for future meetings. I believe, I at least remember one, that was the one I suggested around technology and email addresses and coordinating documents. Are there other items that were brought up during the meeting or other thoughts around agenda items from the board?
I did have a question. I mentioned this to Heidi. So when I'm the secretary, but I don't take minutes, but then there are minutes about the executive session that I'm recused from that bear my name. So it seems like that's a problem, I think.
Yeah, I discussed that with Heidi this morning and we've come up with a resolution.
Oh, great.
Not signed. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, those are the only two agenda items that I have, the technology one and the possible substantive policy statement around ARS 32-2075-A1.
Okay, and that, very good. Anything else? No? All right. Then we will move to 19, adjournment. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
A second.
All right. Let it be known that Dr. Meyer beat everybody and everybody else agreed. Thank you, everyone. Meeting is now, all in favor was an aye. So yes, meeting is now adjourned. We will see you all at respective committee meetings or the next board meeting. Have a wonderful weekend and talk to you all soon.